Well, good morning, everybody. Great to be back together again. I always enjoy day two of these meetings. Everybody's very upbeat and enthusiastic after an exciting first day. Lots of positive discussions. Everybody had an early evening, good night's rest. The sun is shining. So we're all looking forward to lively discussions today. I think we have continue to have a very good agenda and look forward to everybody's active involvement, just as we had yesterday. Our first topic we're going to discuss deals with accounting changes and the impacts of those accounting changes on auditing. As you recall, and I mentioned yesterday, we discussed, and we had Larry Smith here last time discussing the pace and volume of change in front of us. Today we're going to move a little bit went into this in more detail with a greater focus on the nature of change that's taking place and looking at the nature of that change and the impact or potential impact on auditing. So first I'm going to ask Charlie Niemeyer to lead us off on this discussion. Charlie, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Marty. Certainly we did have a discussion at the last SAG meeting and I think fairly focused on the speed and volume of the proposals. It's rather unprecedented in those regards. Today, we would like to focus more on the substance of the proposed standards, and in particular, auditability. For our financial reporting system to be effective, it's no doubt it must be reliable, and auditability is closely related to reliability. Certainly, through our inspections, PCAOB has a great deal of information. Yesterday, you had some insight into that in our discussion of the 4010 report related to the economic crisis. I think Denny Beresford was right in his insight that we our findings related to the economic crisis are probably not unique to the economic crisis. Certainly we continue to find our findings related to fair value auditing. Auditing of goodwill of estimates are a consistent theme in our inspection reports. And I sincerely hope that the PCAOB will publicly share these insights and continue to do so as we, as I believe information such as this could be beneficial not just to the to FASB but to the public at large and setting the accounting standards. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tony Lopez, and Deputy Chief Auditor.
Thanks, Charlie. This morning what we wanted to do is review some of the key changes to the standards, and our objective is to focus on key changes so that will serve as a basis for determining which of those changes present auditability issues. And after that, we're going to then have a discussion of the topics in the briefing paper that was sent. The first standard in the deck is the revenue recognition standard. As many of you know, the FASB is moving away from the traditional longstanding earned and realized approach to recognizing revenue and has adopted a contract asset and liability approach where you record contract assets and liabilities and recognize the changes in those as revenue, a balance sheet approach, if you will. The revenue ASU is applicable to most contracts involving the delivery of goods and services with some exceptions, for example, leases and insurance. And in the briefing paper, we outlined the model for revenue recognition, which is you identify the existence of a contract, identify performance obligations, determine the transaction price, and then allocate that to the performance obligations. The under the proposed standard, recognition of revenue occurs only from the transfer of goods or services. So if you have contracts for the construction of assets, for example, the degree to which you recognize revenue will be based upon whether control is transferred. If it's transferred continuously during the contract, you'd recognize revenue. If it's transferred toward the end, you would recognize when control transfers to the buyer, generally speaking. In terms of the identification of separate performance obligations, that's similar to what is done today in practice with multiple element arrangements where you basically look at the deliverables and unbundled deliverables.
What's a little different about performance obligations is that the performance obligations have to be distinct, and that's defined as either they're sold separately or they have a distinct function and profit margin. But so you'll have some similarity there, but the unit of accounts may be the same. In terms of licensing and right to use, one of the things that the new proposed standard calls for is you would look at the exclusivity of the license and the term of the license. Licenses that were exclusive licenses for the economic life of that license, you would get a sale model with revenue recognition up front, generally speaking. If the life was less than the, if the term of the license was less than the economic life, you would have revenue recognized continuously during the term of the license. And if it was non-exclusive, you'd recognize revenue no earlier than the inception of the agreement. In terms of effective credit risk, collectability, as we pointed out in the briefing paper, is no longer a recognition threshold issue. It's something that the proposed model would include in measurement. And the FASB has taken many troublesome, what have traditionally been troublesome revenue recognition issues like rebates, concessions, price protection, and they factored those into measurement rather than being recognition thresholds. As it relates to the use of estimates, the FASB in its own document says this standard will require significantly more estimates than are used today. And for example, in the transaction price, you would use the relative standalone selling prices to allocate the transaction price to different performance obligations. I think practice currently is having some getting up on the learning curve in using estimates because of the two EITF issues 081 and 093. So that would be similar to the evolving model today. In terms of accounting for costs, cost would be expensed unless there is a particular gap that allows deferral of costs, or if the costs relate to the fulfillment of the contract, they're direct cost, and they will be contractually recovered through the revenue contract. One point I'll note about the revenue standard is, as of yesterday, there have not been significant comment letters issued because the deadline is October 22nd. Moving on to the financial instruments exposure draft, this represents also a significant change in the model. As of yesterday, there were over 2,000 comment letters, and I think yesterday many people noted about in the 4010 report there are significant issues that audit firms sometimes have in dealing with fair values, and in this standard, one of the changes, the first change we have up there, is that most financial assets and liabilities would be measured at fair value. Some of the comment letters that the staff looked at in terms of audit issues raised, some said that loans and non-marketable equity securities, for example, may not have a readily discernible market, and therefore that's going to require the use of more level three fair values, and some have suggested that would reduce comparability. Other commenters on the requirement to fair value have said the requirement to fair value certain equity instruments may be difficult to operationalize because of the lag in getting the underlying information that investors, that issuers typically have in doing their normal equity pickup. Now that they have to fair value that, some have said that would be perhaps more difficult to operationalize. In terms of classification based upon intent for held to maturity securities today, it's an intent basis, whereas in the new proposed standard, it will be based on business strategy, that is the strategy of someone holding the instrument to recover or pay the contractual cash flows at the end of the term. Comment letters on that particular, some comment letters have raised issues about it's the business strategy being unclear. For example, can you have a deviation in a business strategy? Does it matter if the strategy is a long-term strategy versus a short-term strategy? And some of those commenters have requested more application guidance to address those issues. Core deposit liabilities would be measured at current value, and they would be remeasured. And demand deposits that are not core liabilities would be subject to fair value. A number of the comment letters on that particular aspect indicated that remeasurement that would be required for core deposit liabilities is subject to significant judgment. It may result in the creation of a new measurement attribute that may be confusing to auditors. In terms of the impairment model changes, there will no longer be a probable threshold for recognizing impairment. Rather, an issuer would look to current and past events and would not be allowed to look to future events. And some of the comment letters have also expressed the need for more guidance there because some have said certain indicators that are used in determining impairment may embed forward-looking sub-indicators, and therefore, practically, it may be difficult to separate future from current events when considering impairment. And then finally, up there, hedge relationships. We included that in the briefing paper. The focus is a move to more qualitative assessment at using a reasonably effective threshold. Now, many were supportive of the reasonably effective threshold. Some of the questions that issuers raised was that they were concerned that auditors and or regulators would come along and impose what I'll call a belts and suspenders approach, where they come in and maybe informally mandate a quantitative approach in addition to the qualitative approach. There was one large audit firm who applauded the board for including a reasonably effective threshold, but they were concerned about regulators coming in and applying a similar belts and suspenders approach. In terms of the fair value ASU, now the FASB in the exposure draft indicated that they didn't believe that this was going to result in significant changes in practice, and many of the changes were done for convergence purposes. One of the changes we highlighted in the briefing paper is the requirement for a level three uncertainty, measurement uncertainty analysis, and the document essentially says that if changing one unobservable input to a different input could have reasonably resulted in a significantly higher or lower fair value, that you would need to disclose that. Comments, some comment letters on that in terms of auditability were along the lines of requiring an entity to disclose a second estimate that it did not come up with may be misleading. Others indicated that the phrase could have reasonably been used and the term significantly are not defined, and that may lead to diversity. And there were some large financial service issuers who commented on third-party pricing services relative to this requirement. They said the availability of the information to do this disclosure may be difficult to get from pricing services, and some pricing services treat that information as proprietary. And even if you can get it, there is a lag in terms of getting that information timely for quarter and year-end reporting. And others said even if you overcome those issues of availability and the lag issue, that different pricing services use different methodologies. So one issuer may have a disclosure that itself is not comparable because it's based upon two different pricing services with different methodologies. Skipping down to the third bullet there, the current valuation premise under FASB guidance for highest and best use includes two approaches, in use and in exchange. And in this proposal, the FASB is eliminating those, and they've said that the concept of highest and best use will apply to only non-financial assets and liabilities. So for financial assets and liabilities, you can no longer, you can't measure them based upon grouping. You have to look at the unit of account. The FASB included one exception, which says if you're managing market and counterparty credit risk, offsetting risk, on the basis of a net exposure, that you can measure the fair value at that unit of account of the portfolio. And as we say in the slide, you can do that if the risks being offset are substantially the same. Some have commented that substantially the same isn't defined, although there weren't as many calls for application guidance in this instance as in some of the other instances. The final bullet up there is simply that 157 was focused on establishing valuation premise for assets and liabilities, and the FASB made an amendment to say that if in terms of valuing an entity's own equity that's included in shareholders' equity that's required to be measured at fair value, you should take the same market participant approach. And the example was, for example, in a business combination where you're issuing securities to affect the combination. The last standard that I want to cover is the contingencies disclosure proposal. There were over 300 comment letters that the FASB received, and the comment letter deadline was extended. We focused in the briefing paper on the requirement to disclose remote contingencies, asserted remote contingencies that may have a severe impact. And the requirements for disclosure are publicly available quantitative information, other relevant non-privileged information, and information about insurance and other recoveries if they're discoverable. Now, two themes that we saw in the letters that we looked at were that what is publicly available, what is non-privileged, and what is discoverable are items that require legal expertise that auditors may not be in the best position to make a judgment on. The other comment, and I would say at least of the letters we looked at, the substantial majority raised issues of concerns over privilege in terms of auditors getting corroborative information and how they're going to do that without having to violate attorney-client privilege. And one last observation I'll just make about in a summary of the standards is many of the comment letters we looked at were supportive of the board's approach for principles-based standards. But some of those same comment letters asked for detailed implementation guidance. And as we pointed out in the briefing paper, the FASB had a 2002 proposal for principles-based standards, and they said a move to principles-based standards requires at least two things. One is the standard setter's ability to resist calls for more detailed implementation guidance, and the second was that regulators and investors have to be willing to tolerate less comparability and more diversity. And in some of the letters, that was an expectation gap that may need to be addressed. With that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to the first discussion question, which is addressing the increase of fair values estimates and judgments. And Mike Gallagher from PricewaterhouseCoopers has agreed to lead off this first topic about challenges to auditing given the greater diversity in some of these standards. Mike?
Thank you, Tony. Good to see you. At the last session, we talked about the pace of change and potentially the challenges to the quality of the standards. And one of the things that we got into was the movement towards more judgment. And clearly, what we have today is not absolute rules, and where we're going is not absolute judgment. This is a continuum. I'll tip my hand at the beginning. I'm, as I said at the last session, I think it's a step in the right direction. Right? Movement towards greater judgment is a positive thing, but certainly it's got, some issues that need to be dealt with. Tony, I think you did a good job of teeing up, some of the obvious judgments that come with some of the new standards. Revenue recognition, just by way of example, contingent consideration, which in the past, largely had been recognized at the, completion or the outcome of the contingency, will now be recognized, when it's reliably estimable based on some probability weighting. So that's certainly a matter of judgment. And as the question tees up, you could get, similar facts or almost identical facts, and you can have people make different judgments. Financial instruments, certainly the greater use, as Tony said, the greater use of level three valuations, and certainly that was an issue that was identified in the 4010 report. The interesting part about that is in the most extreme circumstances, we went to level three, and we went there very quickly, and a lot of people had to move and make judgments with very little time under very extreme circumstances. But as we move to more fair value and more prolific use of fair value, certainly level three will become more prolific and will require much greater judgment, and by definition, you will have different answers and therefore a lack of consistency or comparability. Leasing. Now that everything will be on the balance sheet, there is no longer a concept of an operating lease. There's the right to use model, so there will be a balance sheet entry when you enter into a lease, and that number will change based upon a number of different assumptions, including something as basic. It sounds simple, but lease term. You know, lease term is anything but simple when you think about options and when you think about, you know, the definition, you know, the longest possible term that's more likely to occur, more likely than not to occur. So, you know, that's very judgmental and could change significantly from period to period, and certainly different people can end up with different judgments. Under the auditing standards, you currently have a requirement, and it makes sense that to the extent that judgment increases and you're applying judgment, the documentation should increase. So by definition, our audit files will be getting a little bit more hefty, for sure. But you get into the issue of could different people come up with different reasonable judgments. One, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be wrong in order for the other to be right. So the challenges, you know, are clear. Comparability and consistency is the obvious one. From an investor standpoint, does that serve the community to have potentially different answers on very similar facts? I think the challenge there will largely get to the quality of disclosure. Will the disclosures be the link between and make things a little bit more comparable if you compare those disclosures? And will the disclosures do a good job of connecting the accounting with the economics? And I think that will be the real challenge. And if you look at rules versus judgment, you know, it's interesting the dichotomy that you mentioned, Tony, that people are asking for principles, but they're saying, well, give me a rule that helps me interpret the principle. And I understand that, you know, rules are a hard thing to kind of wean yourself off of. That, you know, rules can be very comfortable from an auditor standpoint sometime, for sure. I'll speak for myself from my perspective. When you're in a challenging conversation with a client regarding an issue, and if you have a rule there, sometimes it makes that conversation a little bit easier to say, well, you know, this is the rule, as opposed to management making a judgment and our firm making a judgment, me making a judgment, and having a difference of view when there's nothing definitive that says, well, you know, show me in the rule book where I'm wrong and you're right. And yet it's still important for an auditor to stand up. It's important for controllers and so forth, you know, to express their views, and recognizing that there may be a range of acceptable answers. Just because something's judgmental doesn't mean anything goes. I mean, there are judgments that are not within the realm of acceptability, and so certainly the profession would need to stand up, and to the extent that judgments are outside that realm of acceptable, being able to stand up in the absence of having the comfort of a rule, you know, to rely on. So that will be a challenge. But I think the benefits are significant as well. You know, I think if it's done right, I think, you know, having principles versus specific rules can end up with better financial reporting and will serve the user community better. The more rules you have, the more you're trying to fit similar transactions that may not be identical, you know, into a box that may not fit so neatly. And if you look at the amount of rules that have accumulated over so many years, and leasing to me is a great example. You know, you have so many complicated rules as they exist today in applying leasing, and I'm convinced if you're a good accountant and you make a good judgment and you try to connect the accounting with the economics with respect to leasing as it exists today, you're almost guaranteed to get the wrong answer, because the accounting as it exists today in many cases is counterintuitive. We'll go back to the middle of this decade. Where you had so many restatements. You had roughly 10% of all public companies end up restating their financial statements, and many of those had to do with leasing. You had the retail community, which, you know, obviously is very much in the leasing. There were massive amounts of restatements, and again, largely, you know, that accounting in that sector built up over time, and it built up by people applying reasonable judgment. But you know what? The rule was fairly clear, and if you followed the rule, you got a very different answer. So I think the use of judgment and having principles versus rules, hopefully there's far less of them. It's easier to comprehend because as it exists today, no one individual could possibly understand all the rules that are out there, hence the need for a national office at each of the big four firms, And quite frankly, it's a challenge even for people that spend a lot of time in this day in and day out. So going to, you know, to more principles and having it be more intuitive and having the accounting be better linked to the economics and reliance on good, high-quality disclosures, not to make up for bad accounting, but to better describe the basis of accounting and why it makes sense and why it might be a little bit different. So I think those benefits are significant. And I guess the last thing I'd say about the benefits is I think it's an opportunity, you know, again, maybe speaking a little bit selfishly, I think it's a benefit for the profession, and it gives the profession an opportunity to elevate itself in providing value to the capital markets, in helping our clients, audit committees, management teams, et cetera, in making high-quality judgments that will better reflect economics in the financial statements, as opposed to being there to, you know, explain to the controller where in 20,000 pages of U.S. GAAP where the rule is that tells you what to do. Okay, you know, not giving the recipe, but helping our clients and audit committees make high-quality judgments, I think is good for the profession. So from an auditing standpoint, I guess the question comes up, and I know we'll discuss it, is what does this mean in terms of the need for auditing rules? And do these accounting rules precipitate that need? And as I look at it, I really don't see it. I mean, I'm open as these things develop, and you know, practice will develop, and we'll see what happens. But I certainly today would not call for a specific need for, you know, for auditing standards to address some of the accounting issues. I think one of the things that we discussed at our last session was an auditor judgment framework. I think that should certainly be explored. I know there's two sides to that coin, but you know, on balance, I guess the way I look at the auditor judgment framework, similar to what the Committee to Improve Financial Reporting came up with on the accounting side, is, you know, can we come up with some best practices or a process that hopefully will result in high-quality judgments? Again, not a checklist approach, and just as there shouldn't be a safe harbor for a poorly done or poorly executed framework, I don't think the absence of documenting the framework every single time is indicative of a low-quality judgment. I think that ultimately the judgments need to stand on their own, and if the judgments are documented properly and they're well thought out based on the facts that are known at the time, that's ultimately what we're getting at. But I think an auditor judgment framework that provides, you know, a process for auditors and others to think about how do you make high-quality judgments will raise the quality of judgments that are out there, and hopefully, again, not to create a safe harbor, hopefully avoid the crash rather than trying to figure out who to blame after the crash occurs. So, Marty, those are, and Tony, those are my thoughts, hopefully, to tee up a good discussion.
Okay, thanks. And with that, we'll open it up for other questions. One thing I will note, you had mentioned the framework. I know not some of the members weren't here yesterday. I think Dan had talked about the PCOB's thoughts around the framework. And I think at the last SAG meeting, Brian Croteau had mentioned that the framework is out there. Those 11 principles are out there for firms and issuers to look at. And I think we heard that some issuers in terms of dealing with the SEC are currently, and Corp Fin and OCA at the SEC may be applying those same principles without any formal guidance. So.
Mike, I have a follow-up question for you, if that's all right.
Sure.
I was wondering about your view about the staffing model. Given what's been described here of a much more a framework that's filled with much more judgments and estimates and lack of rules in many cases, lack of application guidance, and given the fact that most audits follow sort of a pyramid approach where I think everybody's aware of the fact that a very large proportion of the audit work gets done by people with 1 to 6 years experience, for instance, who are in the past have been trained on rules as they came through, you know, their accounting programs and auditing programs and understood what the rule was in a certain area. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think that model is going to change in terms of will you need to staff jobs with people with greater experience in order for them to audit something where they're auditing a judgment that's been made and the judgment, therefore, they have to bring to that situation?
Yeah, Marty, I think it's a good point.
But as I think about staffing today, you know, generally you're not having the first-year staff person, you know, devote, you know, even on, in a rules-based environment, you know, go find the rule, or, you know, I think that's generally done by the more senior staff in any event. When you get into more judgment, you know, obviously the judgments that are most material, the judgments that are most complex, and as I said, you know, at the outset, you know, this is not, you know, a light switch where we went from 100% rules to, you know, 100% judgment. You know, I think we're moving on the continuum. But, you know, so clearly the more important judgments, the more material judgments, the more complex judgments will continue to be need to be made by the more experienced people on the engagement. You know, whether that movement is a significant shift and will require a significant shift in the staffing model, I don't think so just yet, because I don't think it's that gigantic of a shift. But, you know, certainly we'll have to, you know, we'll have to deal with that as, you know, as practice develops.
Okay, Lynn Turner.
A number of thoughts here, Marty, and let me start by saying I think I couldn't agree more with Mike about the fact we're all trying to get to good judgments here. It's what it's all about. The problem in the past, though, hasn't been the good judgments. It was the ones that were out of whack, and those were the ones that cost investors a ton of money, and ultimately, in all likelihood, cost the firms a lot of money through litigation costs. So I think to some degree the focus has got to be on how do we make sure we don't get into those situations again. I personally think if we go down this path with the standards, it would behoove the PCAOB to get ahead of the game and do some new auditing standards, go back into the estimates standard and all, and beef it up. and that includes all the nuts and bolts that go with it, including the staffing model. I think the question you raised, Marty, is absolutely an excellent one. I'm surprised by Mike's comment that he doesn't think the staffing model needs to change. I think with the additional judgment that's going to be required here, there's going to need to be significant changes. I think early on in the process, you're going to need much more experienced people getting into these judgments. A lot of these judgments on the preparer side will be made by people that are sitting there at the business with 10, 15, 20 years of experience. And to think that you can send out an auditor with 1 to 6 years and understand that the 1 year aren't making some of these judgments, but it sure isn't a person out there either with even remotely close to the experience level that's going to be in that the company has when they have to make those decisions. And in fact, the people out there are out there from the audit firm for only a limited period of time. So I think the business model needs to be examined. And that includes the responsibility of the partner in terms of billing responsibility. Right now, the partners have a tremendous amount of billing responsibility. They're responsible for knocking down so many hours and so much in revenues with these documents coming out. If we got the partner still responsible for as many hours as they are today and as much in fees, we're going to have a train wreck, because you're just not going to be able to bring the experience that you need to decisions. They're not going to get enough attention of the partner, because his feet or her feet are going to be held to the table for those billings, and we're going to have a real problem with respect to that. I think as far as the judgment framework, I think it's absolutely very important that in these standards, the FASB turns around and lays down a standard for what they expect to be documented by the preparer. If it isn't getting documented by the preparer, the likelihood that the auditor is going to do a good job of auditing those judgments drops dramatically, and the odds are we will have problems. I'm very concerned when I look at the standards that the FASB is writing them just as they have in the past, and isn't getting into the documentation that's going to be required. And people may say, well, that shouldn't go into accounting standards. Well, these aren't standards like what we've had in the past, and what we've had in the past isn't going to work in this environment. So I think it's very important that, as the CIFRA committee recommended, that the companies do go through a process for making these estimates and judgments, and that process is well documented, so there's something there for the auditor to audit. I am vehemently opposed to a safe harbor of any shape, kind, or form, because all that does will get us into bad judgments. I listened to Jim Scher say something yesterday that really resonated with me. He said, you know, liability does have an impact on what the auditors do. And I couldn't agree with him more. I think liability does have a big impact on how auditors behave and think. And when you remove that liability, they behave totally different. So I think any notion, consistent with what Jim said, any notion of a liability cap on these judgments or a safe harbor should be totally off the table and out of discussion. As far as back to the reasonable judgments, Michael mentioned the 200 to 300 restatements that there were for leases amongst the business community back in the 3-4 years ago. When you look at those, that had nothing to do with reasonable judgment. Most of those restatements were a flat-out violation of the rule. And that's the thing that we're very concerned about. And in fact, I remember being on the phone with the controller of one of the largest retailers when he turned around and said, Lynn, we'd like you to go lobby the SEC with us. And I said, well, lobby him on what? He says, well, this thing on leases, what they're asking us to do a restatement. I said, well, did you comply with the rule? And he said, no, but none of us were. So as long as we were all breaking the rule, let's go ahead and the firms have all bought off on the financial statement. Let's go lobby the SEC and Congress and see if we can't get them to agree that we get a pass. That's the type of judgments that we're talking about that are dangerous. And those have nothing to do with the notion of good or bad judgments. Those were just flat-out violation of the rules that the firms gave them a pass on and never should. And I think once it did get into the national offices did the right thing for the most part and got the restatements done. But the rules were very clear, and everyone knew what they were at that point in time. The last thing, which comes back to our discussion yesterday, and I think this is extremely important, when we're talking about the risk things, the risk standards, we got into this discussion about whether or not the auditor has to search for just corroborating information for management's numbers or whether the auditor has to search for contrary evidence. And when you start doing these type of judgments, if it isn't clear that the auditor has to search for contrary evidence, we will absolutely have poor judgments. So one of the things that needs to be clarified, as we heard yesterday, and I understand it's very consistent with the new risk standards, is the auditor has an obligation to look and see if there's contrary information, and if so, give that due consideration vis-a-vis what corroborating information management is given, and then make a truly independent decision. Because today, I think, all too often, the auditors have just gotten corroborating information from management and left it at that. And if we're required to make some of these very significant estimates, and the auditors do that, all I can say is God save them, because I think we'll have some real problems, and those of us on the investor side will be coming back and trying to recoup our losses.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. That was good input and a good counterpoint to Mike's comments. Charlie Niemeyer?
I just wanted to raise one thing, and that is that, you know, we have a lot of discussion about how disclosure will be a solution to the problem. So the wild pitches will be caught, you know, by disclosure. What I want to point out is just that I think we should recognize that disclosure is not an area of strength in U.S. financial reporting today. I think there's a number of reasons for that. Perhaps when it comes to materiality, auditors, companies, audit committees even don't quite know what to do with it. But the end result is the same. I think we certainly saw it in the economic crisis, where even companies, financial institutions that complied with the accounting standards as far as the numbers presentation did not comply as far as disclosure. And there was a sort of a rampant failure to comply with the disclosure requirements in that regard. And so I just sort of question whether disclosure is a reasonable backstop. If we're going to do that, that's fine. Certainly I'm not against better disclosure. Certainly we should be doing that. But I think we have to do something as an effort to improve disclosure for it to be reasonable.
Thanks, Charlie. Wayne Collins, I believe you were next.
Yeah, I just wanted to drill down in the prior discussion we had about the revenue ED. On the one hand, certainly it's great to see that we have a significant reduction of the standards. I mean, it's like a telephone book of standards we have now, and the ED proposes a very robust revenue framework, which is, I think, going to make it easier and perhaps more consistent analysis of determining whether revenue is appropriately recognized. Supplementing Mike's comments on the revenue part, I mean, you're starting off with a reasonable estimation of the variables that go into a transaction price, contingencies, rebates, refunds, and reasonably estimated is a lower threshold than the current gap is. So to that extent, you've increased the amount of judgment that's required. The probability weightings that may be needed in assessing and measuring these variables are going to have to be updated each reporting period. And to connect it to a statement that was made yesterday, you've got, you know, 60-day reporting requirement at the year end and more accelerated during the quarters. And all of these estimates are going to have to be done within that same time frame, which adds to the difficulty in the measurement process. In the contingent revenues, you've got and the contingent revenue is probably the primary variable that is that could be included in the transaction price. You've got things that could be very judgmental, like future royalty payments that are contingent on a customer's sales, and that would have to be included in the current revenue if it's reasonably estimated. And there could be possibly issuers, including from just a business standpoint, more of these types of arrangements in a transaction as a result of the new accounting treatment for them. Then once you get the transaction price, you wind up allocating it to the separate performance obligations, so separate and distinct obligations, another judgment, whether something is separate and distinct. And then when you're allocating the transaction price, you're doing it based on estimated selling prices. There has been recent experience dealing with that in the software business, but still there are situations where an estimated price may be difficult to come up with because there are not independent sales of the same product. Competitors aren't selling it separately. So, again, that's something adding to the judgment calls. In terms of the credit worthiness, which is an upfront measurement that has to be done rather than the back end where you're looking to see whether collectability is reasonably assured, but now you're estimating the credit worthiness up front. There's an interesting element of this, and on the one hand, you're reducing significantly the plethora of industry-specific guidance around, but on the other hand, you're basically eliminating that industry-specific guidance. So it's very likely that there will be calls among preparers, auditors, for more guidance to how to apply the more robust uniform framework to specific industry situations. So that's perhaps where additional guidance may be needed. The form of that guidance, I don't know at the present time, but I think that's likely to be called for. Another area where judgment is going to be required is if you have a continuous transfer of a product. The old percentage of completion accounting is an example. And determining whether something or a product is customer-specific is another judgment call as to what model that you apply to those situations. Contract modifications is another judgment call because that determines what the accounting is. Even the cost, determining whether something is a pre-contract cost, which needs to be expensed, versus a post-contract cost, which doesn't get expensed, is another judgment call. Then you deal with the disclosures, and the disclosures around the measurements and the judgments that are required will be another interesting judgment in determining the extent to which the disclosures are appropriate, because there's a lot of judgment that goes into what is a reasonable amount of disclosure surrounding the company's accounting. Then you're looking at all the accounting parts, and you're saying, okay, now I have to evaluate the company's internal controls over financial reporting to the extent you've got an accelerated filer. So the same judgments that are applied in determining what the accounting is, or similar judgments, will be applied to determining whether the company has the appropriate controls to do that accounting. And in all of this, when you put it all in one pot, maybe piling on the judgment framework, which we mentioned today again, without a safe harbor, but the judgment framework that's for preparers, that's for auditors, and that everybody could look to as a consistent way of analyzing what the appropriate accounting would be, I think is sorely needed in this situation.
Wayne, thanks. A lot of good points there. As I listened to those in the context of some of the comments, good comments that Mike made and the points Lynn and Charlie and others have made, clearly, as you pointed all these things out, it cried out for a need for something, therefore, in order to have financial reporting and auditing that's going to be reliable. So in your view, I don't know if you want to answer which one of these three were the best, because I've heard some of these ideas come up, but do you think it's in need of more application guidance with respect to the standards? As I heard Lynn say, is it in need of preparer documentation requirements surrounding these judgments, or increased auditing guidance around the process of auditing estimates, or is it all three?
I was going to say, do I just have to pick one of the three? I think the first two are basically part of the same, because I think part of the CIPA recommendations would be that these judgments need to be appropriately documented. So I think I would blend those two together, and it's likely that there will be some application guidance that's needed. I think we're going to have to see how it goes along. I certainly wouldn't foreclose it.
Thank you.
Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I want to start with something. I agree with most of what Lynn said, particularly on the issues regarding documentation and the need to find something other than corroborating information, and what he talked about, the unacceptability of having a safe harbor. But I do want to take exception to one thing he said, starting out, which is that we're all trying to get to good judgments. And the reality is that there always have been and always will be companies that are trying to get to bad judgments, and not because they're trying to commit fraud necessarily, but because they're overly aggressive. And they manage to convince themselves, and too often they've also managed to convince their auditors, that what the judgment they're getting at is within that range of acceptability. And it seems to me that what we're doing here with this approach is moving towards something that arguably could give us better financial statements for good companies, companies that are trying to get to good judgments. Maybe we get to financial statements that better reflect the actual financial condition of the company. Although even that comes with a price, because we're told the price is less comparability, more divergence of practice, when we were sold convergence on the grounds that it created more comparability. But we'll leave that aside for a moment. But we are creating standards that will make it easier for bad companies, overly aggressive companies, to push the edge of the envelope and argue that their judgments are within that range of acceptability. And we are creating standards that will make it considerably harder for auditors to do what they already have a lot of trouble doing, which is challenge those judgments and argue that they're not within the range of acceptability. Because, as you say, you know, with that, deprived of that argument of it's, you know, it's against the rules, how do you push back against the judgments? They're not always willing to do it now. So we're going to promote more of the kind of things that auditors currently do poorly. And, you know, I feel like you sort of watching the front end of a train wreck. That what's going to happen is at some point in some fairly significant cases, we're going to go outside the bounds of what's acceptable. There are going to be a rash of these major accounting frauds again, and the whole system's going to blow up. And nobody at that point is going to care that the auditors followed something that looked like a reasonable judgment framework. I mean, the level of anger from Congress and the public is going to be extensive. And I just think this is, you know, that since we appear to be heading this direction, really nailing down some of these issues, like having to document, you know, there has to be some documentation that you can reasonably expect to audit. There has to be documentation then on the auditors of how they got comfortable with those estimates, and there absolutely has to be something in the process that looks at more than just corroborating what it was that management set out to do. There has to be, you know, something that really sort of formalizes that requirement for skepticism and to approach those estimates and valuations and judgments with a real skepticism that has been pretty, you know, hard to find at times.
Okay, thank you. Next is Neri Buxban.
Thank you. I want to react to a few things, not necessarily in any order of significance, but it strikes me as very important discussion. It strikes me as a case that almost everybody is right. So when you listen to every single comment here, you must say everybody's right, and maybe some are more right than others in different circumstances. It starts with, what is accounting? What accounting should convey, which is beyond the question of this board, but simply what accounting is. And I'm going to react to several topics, but the bottom line of my message is that I think assumptions, estimates, and judgments always been part of accounting to a certain extent. Yes, they are increasing, but they have been a significant portion of accounting. Loan loss reserves is a major, major assumption. Depreciation, whether you want to use double declining balance, sum of the digits, straight line, machine hours, or anything similar, has been a judgment. Lower of cost on net realizable value has been a judgment. And the list goes on. The question, and I think Michael made the comment that the profession should rise to the challenge. I think if there's one profession that seems to be the immediate candidate to rise to the challenge, is the auditors. You know, carpenters are not going to do it. Taxi drivers are not going to do it. They're probably going to be the auditors. So if you think that estimates and assumptions are important in this context, they're clearly relevant. And I will use another example just to put it somewhat in context or an analogy. And it helps me think through the process. Let's say that I stand in the midst of Central Park in mid-July, and I had a really good measurement tool to measure the temperature. And I know that it's 85 degrees. And then I find myself in the same environment 2 quarters later, at December 31st. And it's really, really cold, but measurement tools are no longer available because of some unique circumstances. All the thermometers are gone. So I said, the last time I was here, it was 85, must be 85. So should I close my financial statement with 85, or should I move to a level 3 measurement and tell you that it's really, really cold, my knees are shaking, and it must be something in the range of, and why? And why do I use this analogy? Because it's very vividly evident in the context of certain instruments, that if I'm a user and I'm getting, the instruments are traded, they're measured, it's very easy to measure, and we all feel comfortable with the value, and then the market dries up. What should we do? Should we revert to a different accounting method? Should we flip every quarter? Should we flip every couple of years when the economic environment is changing? It is very difficult framework for users. So you can appreciate the challenges in getting to a measurement, but you can also appreciate the challenges in thinking about an accounting framework that will be highly dependent on only something that I can measure precisely. And that speaks to the need to start thinking about what accounting means. And what I would speak to what investors need, and I agree wholeheartedly with Charlie, that the disclosures will not provide a silver bullet. Absolutely not. But will they provide you with something? Because, and we'll start with some divergence. But over time, things will converge. I think the fact that you cannot precisely measure everything or gets to consistency does not mean that you should not have judgment. From an investor standpoint and spending a lot of time with financial statements, what I've learned that consistency is in many respects illusory. And we're learning about it every time you have a financial debacle or anything, and then you look at the accounting rules and you see how being applied, and because of estimates. The question is, how low can you go with respect to the level of estimates? So given that, my bottom line, it must rely on a broader system that will think about, you know, accounting standards, and to Lynn's point, whether the accounting standards or something else will prescribe what type of documentation judgment should take shape, absolutely. Should there be some framework to say what's framework to audit those judgments? It's not the same as confirming cash. It's a different process. Should it, and that's probably where the board can play some sort of a role in my mind. And the question is, you know, maybe you don't need a level one, level two auditing, but there's a clear framework to that you audit judgments somewhat differently than you audit cash. It's also close to the level of talent. If you need to audit something that's more complex, by definition, you need, you know, if you're going to look and trying to decipher how NASA is assembling, you know, some complex vehicle, you need somebody with equal knowledge of complexity. So, if those estimates and assumptions are highly complex, I think the accounting firm should match skill those talents. And it's not that they don't do it today. It just seems evident that to the extent that this exists, there's some elements of talent, and if for anything, even if the talent exists, should speak to a notion of validation. Then the third layer in this discussion would be the notion of compliance. And this goes to Barbara's comment. You know, I think when people are speeding, you have two ways to deal with this. One is close the roads, and then there's no speeding. Or two, manage speeding and make sure that you have the right attitude to compliance. So if you do have the framework, I think you may have greater opportunity to do enforcement, compliance, and uproot those potential bad apples. And now if you say that maybe NERI is overly naive, that's never going to work, then you revert to point two. And point two may mean that all you do is financial reporting is something different than judgment, something that's solely non-judgmental. And then you have to rethink what financial reporting is all about. So I think you've got a tapestry of issues, some of which belong with the board, but some of which belongs with a coordinated effort between perhaps market regulators or the board itself, as well as the FASB. So I think it's very difficult to solve in isolation.
Yeah, I certainly take away from your comments the summary you made of a tapestry of issues, as you pointed out. But I also took away, as I listened to you, it sounded again like preparer documentation requirements was something that would be important in this, because when you're making these judgments in Central Park, how you got to whatever that temperature was with the unobservable inputs, if auditors are going to audit something, they need a lot clearer preparer documentation of how they got there, and that's an important takeaway. As well as the fact that the person who's going to audit that documentation needs to have more experience. So thank you very much for those comments.
Doug Carmichael.
It is important for the PCAOB to get out ahead of the game in the standard setting, and I think the key area is for revenue. Wayne did an excellent job of explaining the difficulties are going to be faced with respect to good faith judgments. When you add to that Barbara's very legitimate concern on bad faith judgments, you begin to appreciate the dimensions of the problem. The FASB, for one reason or another, has concluded that it really cannot consider in setting accounting standards management's ability or propensity to distort the results. Their standard setting, they have concluded, I believe, has to be neutral in that regard. But in this particular area, in the revenue area, it is extremely important to recognize that ability and propensity. There's a substantial amount of empirical research. And in the accounting academic world, it's generally referred to as conservatism. But I caution you not to use that label because that doesn't mean the kind of old-style conservatism that the FASB has rejected to anticipate all losses and defer all gains, but one that recognizes that management has the ability and propensity to overstate, and that there is a much greater overstatement risk for revenue, and that investor reaction to that overstatement has more serious consequences. In other words, the investor response to an overstatement of earnings has much more consequence than the investor response to understatement. So the overstatement risk is dramatically greater, and the empirical research does demonstrate that. The fraud risk is greatest in the revenue area. The past frauds tell us, among other things, that they usually start with overly aggressive accounting, that management doesn't start off saying, well, I'm going to have the goal of fraudulently overstating my earnings. It's a temporary effort to deal with the problem, and when things get better, the aggressiveness will be stopped. And if the aggressiveness continues, things don't get better, and it progresses to outright fraud. A lot of that fraud has involved not just fictitious earnings, but a substantial portion of it has been upfronting the revenue, premature recognition of revenue. Fictitious revenue is a problem too, but premature recognition is a significant problem. So I think there is a dramatic need for a new auditing standard devoted to how you audit revenue. And Marty, your questions on that, I would answer with all of the above, but I think there are some very important points. In addition to developing and directing auditors to use more effective procedures in this area, recognizing management's ability and propensity to overstate revenue, that's been done. The recognition of that is there in the auditing standards now, but the response is not there in the auditing standards now. In other words, auditors are advised that they should presume there's a fraud risk for revenue, but when you compare that to the amount of direction they're given on how to deal with that, the direction is fairly paltry. As you were saying, Marty, documentation is extremely important, and I think in this area it is going to be necessary to recognize what I think has always been true, that is that the auditing standards need to start where the accounting standards stop. And it would be nice if the accounting standards specified in more detail the documentation that management needs to support its revenue measurement. If the accounting standards don't provide enough, or wherever the accounting standards stop, that's where the auditing guidance needs to begin. The auditing standards can specify what documentation the auditor needs to see from management in order to give a clean opinion. That's the province of the auditing standards. Wherever the FASB concludes they'll stop in telling people what documentation is needed, that's where the auditing standards should start. Auditing is not supposed to be a best efforts exercise. As one former chairman of the Auditing Standards Committee was fond of reminding everybody, not every client deserves a clean opinion. And it's, in the cases I've looked at, it's too often the case that auditors, it's not that they failed to recognize the problem, but when they faced the problem, concluded, well, they had done the best they could at giving the evidence that was available in the circumstances, and therefore they give a clean opinion, rather than recognizing that the best information available in the circumstances to anybody wasn't enough to support a clean opinion, and it was necessary in that circumstance to disclaim an opinion. And I think that needs to be emphasized in the new auditing standard on revenue recognition. Once you've specified the documentation the auditor needs to see to reach judgment on whether management has met the requirements for revenue recognition, if those requirements haven't been met, the auditor needs to not express an opinion on the financial statements. And then that needs to be dealt with by other regulatory authorities. But to reiterate, the current approach of auditing being a best efforts exercise, particularly in this revenue recognition area, has to be dealt with very directly in the standards.
Thanks, Doug. You made a lot of good points, and but maybe the biggest one I take away, and I think worth repeating, is the auditing standards already state that the auditor should presume that there's a risk of material misstatement due to fraud with respect to revenue recognition. And that's in the environment where we have hundreds of rules about how revenue should be recognized, rules specific to each industry, for instance. And so as Wayne pointed out, there's a lot of challenges now to judgments going into that revenue recognition. And as Barbara indicated, unfortunately, some companies will reach to the most biased, reasonable decision they could judgment they can get to. And so therefore, that risk, the fraud risk presumption that's there now in a rules-based environment, we have to consider that in terms of, well, what does that mean now in this highly judgments-based environment in terms of the increased risk due to fraud in revenue recognition. So I appreciate that point and that concern.
And just to follow up, Doug, in terms of the call for guidance on revenue, one of the things that the staff has heard is we do have guidance in 316 on fraud and some of the new risk standards that talk about confirming terms of with site agreements, and some have suggested the need for perhaps a practice alert that pulls that all together for this new revenue standard. And I just wanted to clarify, were your remarks related to the fraud aspect of revenue or the judgment aspect that's going to be required in this new principles-based standard, or both?
Both. I don't really think you can separate them. The increased use of judgment in the area will create an increased risk to an already serious risk of overstatement in the revenue area. And I think if you are going to get out ahead of the game, this is the area you should target.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
Thank you. Comments on this. I do think that absolutely there's going to be more pressure on our people, on the auditors, and that staffing model needs to be looked at very closely. I really liked those comments about where the accounting stops, the auditing standards have to begin, and it's not a best efforts thing. I think that really resonates. But I'd like to give one example of that. As I was looking through the international standards in this new world of principles-based versus rules, at least on 20 different occasions it talks about the pass, is what I would call it, of having to do something, whether it be evaluation or getting an actuarial report if there is undue cost or effort involved. At least on 20 different instances, that's there, and hopefully the FASB, as they move forward on these new standards that are coming out, that can be avoided, because I think it is a pass. If it ends up being a pass in the accounting standards, the auditing standards are going to have to pick up on that, and you find this in the fair value model. Investments, property, plant, equipment, intangibles, all throughout these standards, you see that sort of language. And And then I just wanted to comment on Neri's comment. I mean, I think that the auditors will ultimately step up to the challenge. I have that kind of faith in them. However, at the same time, it's important to recognize that that's not where it begins. It begins with the CFO and the controller and the company, and the independence involved in this doesn't allow the auditor to make the kind of judgments that the PCOB is not regulating within the company. And so anyway, thank you.
Jim Schnur.
A couple of observations. One, I agree with Neri's point that from an accounting profession standpoint, judgment is not a new thing. I mean, whether it be accounting or auditing judgments, we have to make them every day. The one thing that I think we need to focus on here a little bit is there are two types of judgments. There are accounting judgments and there are auditing judgments. When I look at the 4010 report and I look at the experience with my own firm, I think those comments are primarily auditing judgments. I'm not aware of a lot of situations where the findings that the PCOB inspection staff has led to a restatement. So there isn't a question about the accounting judgments. It's the sufficiency and competency of the audit evidence that the audit firm had with respect to the audit judgment. So, Mike, I guess my question is, should we be focusing on standards or practice aids around what constitutes sufficient and competent audit evidence with respect to these different judgments? So Dan talked yesterday about the fact that the CIFER report had the judgment framework for accounting judgments, and that that Wayne and Jim Croker's staff had been following that. But I think the issue goes to audit judgments. So I think we need to be clear about not confusing the two when we look at this. One of the things that I think we should look at, with respect to, for example, fair value estimates is, are there more efficient ways to gather audit evidence? So Marty talked about pricing services. Well, should there be a mechanism where there's a SAS 70 report around a pricing service so that the individual companies and the firms don't have to go in and effectively audit how the pricing services come up with their estimates of value associated with a particular security. One other point is I do take exception to Barbara's comment that auditors have trouble challenging judgments and do a poor job of that. I can tell you that there are, on a daily basis, we, and I'm sure my counterparts in each of the firms, go and tell clients that the approach they're using with respect to an accounting a judgment or the estimate they have was not appropriate. But we're certainly not perfect. But I don't think we have trouble making those decisions and communicating them, whether it be to management or to the audit committee.
Barbara, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, I was referring in part to the presentation we heard yesterday, which if you look at, in the report on the problems of auditing and the financial crisis, if you look at the things that they document where they saw shortcomings in the auditors, most of them related to this issue of failing to challenge or adequately test evaluations, assessments, judgments. And that's my point. Not that auditors never do it or never do it effectively, and don't, but that it is, it struck me in reading that, that it is one of the hardest things that auditors have to do, and we're designing a system that asks them to do more of it. And, you know, I would get, I would just suggest that there may be lots and lots of audits where it works just fine. That, my basic point was that we're designing a system that may work fine in many cases and then be disastrous in those cases where investors need that system the most.
Thanks, Barbara. Dan?
I just asked Jim a question before we go on. Maybe we're talking past each other a little on this auditing judgment framework. And first, I do understand what you're saying about a difference between auditing judgments and accounting judgments. But it seems to me if we're going to talk about a judgment framework with respect to whether there's sufficient evidence has been gathered in auditing to support a particular assertion, either one of two things would happen. It would have to be at an extremely general level. I mean, it would ask questions like, what's the nature of the evidence I've gathered so far? How objective is it? To what extent do I have contrary evidence? What other steps could I take to gather more evidence? I'm not sure that I see that a framework like that that we might issue would really be of much benefit to people. On the other hand, what you might mean is a judgment framework that looked at specific auditing problems. How do I exercise judgment in auditing a level 3 fair value determination? And if we were to go down that road, it seems to me you're really asking us to write the auditing program for you, and I'm not sure that that's particularly desirable. So if there's something else that's being discussed when we talk about an auditing judgment framework, at least at the moment, I don't really understand what it would be.
Well, Dan, I think some of it does go to it may be specific to the nature of the item that's under audit, right? I mean, we talk about fair value. There's been a lot of dialogue between the staff and the profession about how to interpret the existing auditing standards with respect to, you know, what level of audit documentation needs to be gathered with respect to an individual item. So, you know, does there need to be clarification of what do the words mean? That would be an example. Now, you know, can you put a framework around it? I don't know. That was one of my questions around is there need to be more detailed guidance around what constitutes sufficient and competent audit evidence? Because, as I said, when I look at the report, and I know my own experience, it looks like that's where there's a disconnect, not necessarily that the accounting judgments that a company's made and then the auditors have looked at and concurred with is wrong.
Okay, thanks Jim and Dan. Next, Brian Croteau.
Thanks. I was actually going to raise a question to bring out some of this evidence discussion, which has actually now come out, but so I won't raise that question, but instead I would at least just make the point that I don't think we should forget that companies certainly have a responsibility from a books and records perspective and an internal control perspective to be thinking about what they need for documentation and the controls that they need to have in place. And so as we think about the auditing standards picking up where the accounting standards leave off, I think that's just something we should keep in mind as well, and that should be a source for the auditor to be considering. The only point I'll maybe make on the evidence point is, seems to me we're moving down a path of different sources of evidence than the auditor may be used to obtaining, and not that it's completely new sources of evidence that we've never seen before, but it's a shift in the type of audit evidence, which to me gets at some of the discussion we're just having on are there things the PCAOB could think about doing from the perspective of evaluating audit evidence, considering that we're thinking about a shift in the nature of the type of evidence.
Thanks, Bren. Next, Arch.
Thanks, Tony. Touch on a few things here, and Brian actually just brought up something that I was going to bring up as well, and that is from the standpoint of the preparer. And clearly, when I see the new standards coming out, the preparers are going to have an appropriate process in place to reach the right conclusions themselves, and that comes under the concepts of the internal controls over financial reporting. And to what extent they may need additional guidance in terms of the types of things that they have to have in place in order to record a transaction, I think they're going to need some help there as well. And I'm not quite sure where that help is going to come from. I'm sure the audit firms will provide assistance, but it should be beyond just audit firms, because we all have a common goal. I want to go back to something that Lynn said, and a few others have touched on, and that's the staffing model. I didn't hear anything that Mike said that indicated that a one-year staff person was going to go out and be dealing with somebody on a significant judgment. I don't think any of us would accept that. We never have in the past. What I see in this area, if you want to bring it under the heading of the staffing, is that I think because of the changes in the accounting, it's going to bring in a significant amount of additional consultation requirements that are going to be taking place within the firms, so that we do bring the expertise in areas of these significant judgments. That's happened in the past. I see it happening more going forward with the changes in these. When you look at the revenue rules, and the judgments that are going to be called for there, when you look at the difficulty of how do you apply a change in control to a service contract and things like that, I see the consultation process increasing. I really like Neri's analogy to the closing down the roads. I think, and Barbara spoke about a range of acceptability and the difficulty there, and the only way to solve that is to go back to such rigid rules that there's only one right answer for every single thing. And clearly the FASB, in listening to investors, that's not the direction that investors want. So we are left with things where there's going to be ranges of acceptability, and the challenges are going to come as a result of that. There's a very key sentence, I think, in the paper. It's actually a quote from the FASB, and it says, "Preparers and auditors would need to apply professional judgment in more circumstances. While the SEC, investors, creditors, and other users of financial information must accept the consequences of applying professional judgments, including some divergence in practice." So precision, in my view, precision of financial statements is going down, but the information may be more relevant to investors. If I could, and hopefully everybody's in a good mood here, because I think there should be a word added to that sentence, and that word is inspectors should accept the consequences of applying professional judgments. So back to what was just discussed a minute ago, I think it's imperative that the board works with the firms to understand what's expected, because without that, it seems to me we're going to continue to have all sorts of issues coming up and issues being reported, and I think the confidence of the investors would decline if that continues to happen. So I think we need to have an understanding. We need to have an understanding of what is expected. How are we going to come to a common ground on the types of evidence that everyone is expecting to get in connection with some very difficult judgments?
Thanks, Arch. A couple, just a follow-up points. You asked about where the source of guidance is going to come. One of the things that I've observed in looking at some of these proposals and the comment letters is firms themselves have started to come out with, for example, I think Wayne was talking about the revenue standard. Firms have come out with indicators and criteria that go beyond what the FASB standard itself requires, to helping issuers saying, well, here are some things that we think are relevant in the context of estimating selling prices, in the context of software and specified upgrades. So, again, that seems to be one source that's filling the void. The other observation on you'd made on the inspections, one of the things that I've observed, and is going back to when I was on the SEC staff, is when this whole move towards principles-based standards occurred, one of the things that was said was that regulators need to be, and I think it says in the FASB paper, more tolerant of judgment. And I think that may be we may not be there today, but it may be a process as we evolve towards principles-based standards. But thanks for your comments. Kevin Riley?
Yeah, a couple quick points. The FASB and the IASB are trying to converge accounting standards, and therefore it is critical that we converge auditing standards. And so I implore you, if we're going to go down the track of setting new auditing standards, that you all work hand in hand with the ASB and the IAASB in making sure that we've got the same type of standards applicable to how an auditor might go through the exercise of analyzing revenue recognition. At the same time, Marty, you reviewed the agenda for standard setting yesterday. It is chock-a-block full of stuff, and therefore I think by sharing the pain with the ASB and the IAASB in terms of trying to move the ball forward, I think that would be very helpful from a resource perspective, at least from my vantage point. I think, Marty, your question on the staffing issue is an excellent one. And I think particularly if we're going to march towards a big bang where companies are going to put all this stuff into effect at one point in time, it will have to change how we've got some of our engagement staffed up. So I think we all need to be particularly vigilant about that. And I suspect from a standard setting perspective, it's hard to kind of fit that in to a box other than in the quality control standard. Last on the issue list is, and I think you've heard, on the judgment framework, that from an auditor's perspective, we think that's important. Dan, I do understand your scratching of the head on what's all that means. So the only suggestion I could make is, would it make sense for the firms to put our heads together and try to put together a white paper, come back to you at some future point in time with some thoughts and ideas about what we mean relative to a judgment framework, if you think that would be productive?
I certainly don't see any downside in the firms putting together a paper that would express that view, so we could understand where you're coming from on that. Thanks, Kevin.
Arnold Schulder.
Thanks, Sam. This, of course, is a fascinating discussion, and it makes the trip from Europe to here more than worthwhile. That is a very serious comment. That it also, of course, reminds me a lot of the discussions that we had, in particular about ISA 540, about accounting estimates, and document that I mentioned yesterday, the Practice Statement 1000 about auditing complex financial instruments, and it just has been published yesterday as an exposure draft. So my answer to the question you have there, and I think the answer from many, is a yes. You need revised standards, not or additional guidance, but and. That's precisely the lesson that we have drawn. And listening to Kevin about sharing the pain, but actually that's what we have done. In the case of IAPS 1000, we had an excellent cooperation between IAASB and PCAOB, as mentioned yesterday. So maybe that's at least a good example that it's not only on revising standards but also additional educational guidance. And also listening to Jim Cox yesterday, for universities, this is a typical document that could be of use there. So I would agree that on one hand judgments have been in the profession from the very beginning, but on the other hand I would even more agree to those that have said there is I think Brian called a shift in the nature and the type of evidence and of judgments. It's becoming more over the place, it's more and more qualitative, and it's also more and more challenging management. And that's precisely what I see in the language in ISA 540, evaluating, for example, how management has considered alternative assumptions or outcomes and why it has rejected them, a lot about the documentation that you need for that, accounting documentation as it is. So we are in that reality that auditors have to challenge more and more assumptions and outcomes that management has made. So that's my first point. We have now this reality, and let's make optimal use of what we have jointly produced. in a way. The other point is that there's a very important link to other discussions from yesterday. There is a link to the quality control culture. And there's a number of us have sat standing up. Well, indeed, but that's what you have to learn people how to do that, and you have to promote it. So there is a link to that issue as well. There is a link to audit committees. You also find that in ISA 540, those charged with governance, because certainly the important assumptions, they have to be involved as well. So there's another place to bring it together. Audit reports, of course, education and training, and I agree with Arts, also inspectors. So the conclusion is it's not an issue that you can handle on its own. You have to, on one hand, but it also needs to be taken into account in that much wider context, and that's why I think it's so fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Jim Cox.
I wanted to just comment on a couple of observations or analogies were made here. I think Barbara Roper nailed it when she talks about the dilemma, or really is more of a Hobson's choice when moved from principles from rules to principles accounting. And take us back to discussions we had, and we've had discussion drafts on this. But at the roundtable on the 21st, we talked about auditors' communications and how that would provide an important supplement and useful information, which I think goes partway to trying to give a better view about what the understanding is of financial statements prepared under principles rather than rules, and maybe make that information somewhat more comparable. But the problem is, as Charlie points out with that, is that we tend to think that the disclosure's out there to catch the wild pitch, which I think is a good analogy, because what happens sometimes with these collateral disclosures is they become like milquetoast or boilerplate, and they conceal much more than they really reveal. And I've thought about how to address that concern in the same standpoint of trying to enhance the communications from the auditors to the investor communities, or more particularly maybe even to the audit committee. And that's to think that maybe there ought to be a judgment at the end of the day that's made by the auditor, an evaluation which becomes part of that communication. And you know, we can quibble about where that communication has to go, whether it's going to be out there on the website or whether it's just to the audit committee or perhaps even just to a regulator. I think it ought to be to the audit committee at least. But that communication could be a judgment in maybe five different categories about the combination of the assessments and the judgments and the assumptions that went into it. I mean, one would be aggressive, one would be optimistic, one would be reasonable, one would be pessimistic, and perhaps the fifth one would be the unpardonable. But it would be some evaluation there. Which all auditors would be. And that would be going back to Barbara's point that one of our fears when you move toward principles-based accounting, and this has been out there for a long time in literature, is sort of the tail end of the curve. I mean, these 3-5%, whatever it is going to be out there, there's going to be not because they're necessarily malicious, but just that they're overly aggressive. And knowing that in the investor community, I've got to think, would be extremely helpful in understanding what these financial statements actually mean.
Okay, thanks. Jim, you had touched on disclosures, and a number of people have mentioned disclosures. That is included in our second topic, but it relates naturally to what we're discussing. And so to the extent people have comments on disclosures, we can entertain those as well. One of the things that I think has been constituents have told us in terms of audit challenges, and we put this in the briefing paper, is disclosure is you know, pardon the term, the ugly stepsister to recognition and measurement often. And what often happens is, in terms of issuers dealing with regulators, it's far more likely that a regulator will say, in the next filing, please disclose X, and it's very unlikely, it's rare that they have the same view for recognition and measurement. So, you know, one of the things that we put in the briefing paper is when does a disagreement between auditors and issuers rise to the level of a disclosure difference? So, but that touched upon, Jim, some of the comments you made about disclosures. Next, Doug Anderson.
Thanks. There's a lot of things I agree with in the discussions going, but I just wanted to touch on two points. One is I really think there's a place for the PCOB to get ahead of some of the issues here, but I caution to worry about always writing a rule book in a standard of exactly how to do it. In fact, that's one of my issues with the confirmation standard. I think it's a little bit too prescriptive and doesn't rely a lot on the judgment of the auditor. But I think there's a real space here with each of these standards, accounting standards, to look at other guidance that could be provided, whether it's the Q&A document or a practice alert, to really go through and say, based on the knowledge of inspections that the PCOB has gathered over the years, what are going to be the problems that auditors will have implementing this new accounting standard, and try to get ahead of that with some of this other supplemental guidance. I think there's a strong need for that, but I would caution trying to worry about writing a very prescriptive auditing rule book-based standard for all of these as you move forward, which my example is going to be disclosures. I guess you cue that up, Tony. I was going to say we have some guidance. I think a standard out there now on materiality, and I think that fills a need. As I think about it, I can't think much about disclosure. And I think there's really a good opportunity to, and this could be a nice standard, it could be other guidance, talking about the auditor's responsibility with disclosures and giving more context around that and giving more strength around how to view the adequacy or inadequacy disclosures. I think there are things that could be written there that could be strengthening it, and I do think that's a gap. The other thing I want to mention is the whole question of documentation, and I've always been a very strong proponent of documentation over my many years of doing things. And while I think the PCOB needs to reconsider what is in the current standards and auditor documentation as the need for judgment increases in accounting, that'll probably raise the level of judgment in auditing, so I think that's a good thing to do. But I wanted to, I guess, have a caution on a comment that I heard stated here where that the auditing standards need to pick up where the accounting rules leave off. Because I think there's a gap between those. And I would not like to repeat what we saw when SOX 404 first came out, where effectively the rules for issuers were written by the auditing standards and the firm's interpretation of those auditing standards. And it wasn't until later that the SEC came out with the guidance to issuers of how to comply with having good ICFR in 404. And so I would think there is a place for rules, guidance, whatever you call it, to the issuers directly from the SEC if complying with the new accounting standards makes complying with Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley difficult in the form of documentation. Let's get that guidance out from the SEC directly to the issuers. That's the right body to do it, I would think, not indirectly from the PCOB to the auditing firms, the auditing firms to the issuers. We've done that before. It's dysfunctional, and I wouldn't suggest doing it again.
Okay, thanks, Doug. On your comment on increasing auditor documentation, I think AS3 does include some guidance on, to the extent there's an increased judgment, there's a requirement for increased documentation. Next is Sam Ranzillo.
Thanks, Tony. When you know Lynn Turner leaves before I get to speak.
I don't think there was a connection.
Yeah. let me express my auditor skepticism first. I think Neary said everybody is right, so by definition, everybody is wrong. And I think as it relates to, there's a couple points I want to bring up, but let me pick up on Doug's first, because I think I heard somebody say that the auditors ought to be determining the documentation requirements for management, and I guess I caution this board that was one of the major flaws with the adoption of 404, and one of the major flaws with auditing standard number 2. And I would hope that we would learn from that experience. I also like to pick up on Arch's point, which I think is embedded in this, and I'm going to violate one of my basic principles, which is to use the words principle-based standards and rules-based standards, because quite frankly, there is no such thing as either one of those two. All standards are a combination of both, and I know it's convenient to talk about one versus the other because it's, you feel much more comfortable going to the extreme when you use rules versus principle-based standards to make a point, and I think sometimes those points are invalid. But to Arch's point, and I think the thing that is probably bothering people and is an undercurrent to, I'm gonna use principle-based standards, but is an undercurrent is that what both boards are trying to do is to get to more relevant information. And whether let's just accept for the moment that fair value is more relevant than historical cost. I honestly don't believe that for every financial instrument, but I'll use it to make a point in that fair value is more relevant, but unequivocally it has more measurement uncertainty associated with it. And I think what people are, when they talk about principle-based standards, I think that's sort of the undercurrent is I'm a little uncomfortable moving away from things that are more certain but less relevant. You can say the same thing with respect to revenue recognition. What is most certain is if I buy a sweater, that whoever I buy it from doesn't record the revenue until I throw it away because now I have no right of return left because I threw that sweater away. That is revenue. I don't think anybody would doubt that. Might be 6 years after I bought the doggone thing, but is that very relevant information? And I think the boards are trying to create more relevant information, get information up onto balance sheets earlier than what we have. Revenue, I think, is a good example. I think they're on the right path. But there's going to be some more measurement uncertainty associated with that. When you book a revenue transaction under the new standard, you may not be finished with booking revenue on that transaction. There might be two or three more reporting periods that are affected by that. I think that makes some people uncomfortable, and they're using principle-based standards as sort of the handle to express that. Quite frankly, I think you need to get over it. And there are going to be changes to things that we historically haven't seen changes to. You know, you book revenue and you go back in now and adjust revenue, it's pretty much a restatement. Changes to revenue now are going to become more of a common exercise as we try to better reflect what happened at the point in time. On the judgment framework, I'm probably a little bit different here than my peers in the other firms. I think you cannot have an auditing framework without starting with an accounting framework. So when I looked at the Treasury recommendations, I always, just conceptually, and I've been wrong and probably a half a dozen times since I started speaking, I've been wrong, but I always viewed that as an accounting framework. And I think until you build the accounting judgment framework, which I am a proponent for, I think it's hard to write one, although it looks like Kevin Riley's gonna head us down that path. But and I'm sure I'll be
participating. Sam, I was
going to
turn that over to you.
Yeah, I figured. Well, I said I'm sure I'll be participating. But I do think you've got to start with the accounting and then build off of it. And to the last point, and then I'll shut up. I do, again, using principle-based versus rules-based, but I think a very dangerous cocktail is principle-based accounting standards and rules-based auditing standards. And I, too, have seen some movement in the board towards more prescriptive standards. And I appreciate there's thoughts behind that, but I think writing prescriptive standards where the accounting standards are providing for more judgment, I think that's a really dangerous cocktail, and one that, you know, we'll work our way through it, but I think it'll cause more pain than it's worth. Thanks.
Thanks, Sam. I just wanted to thanks for all those comments, but on the documentation, I didn't hear, maybe you did, but I didn't hear at least anybody from our organization saying that we should go down the path of setting standards for preparer documentation. But I think I did hear that there certainly are a lot of requirements for auditor documentation, and maybe there aren't as many requirements for preparer documentation. And it sounded like a number of people were saying it would be more helpful, especially as these standards are written, which clearly have more, whether you use principles based or what, have more judgments, more estimates, so more judgments based. Requirements for preparer documentation sound like an important aspect of it.
Marty, I don't think it was somebody on the current staff that made that comment. I also don't think that it's FASB's job to set what the documentation requirements should be by preparers. I mean, I think that's not the role of an accounting standard setter, but I don't remember. I think it came from that side of the table that said, well, wait a minute, there's processes that have to be developed. There's internal controls, there's disclosure controls, and procedures that entities have to have in order to sign certifications. That all gets embedded in how do you document your judgments. And I don't think it's like we haven't done that already. It's just I think there's going to be a few more in each of the areas, like revenue, where today you don't have to determine upfront contingent consideration. Your policy is we don't book it till it gets into our bank account. Well, that doesn't leave a lot of judgment. That's not real hard to implement. But now where you're going to have variable consideration, then you're going to have to build processes. And I think somebody made the point that the accounting firms, I think Tony did, I thought it was an excellent point, that accounting firms are writing guidance. And, you know, as we've looked at how do we guide our people or our clients, how you write guidance, accounting guidance, as a national office is very different with standards that are very prescriptive versus ones that provide more judgment. You have to provide a different form of guidance. I mean, it's not you just roll it out there and say, you know, here's some meat, go get it. But you write things in the form of consideration, sort of questions, things you ought to be considering. I think the board has done the same thing in the writing of the accounting standards. So I didn't mean to imply that I heard one of the staff on that you ought to be setting management's standards for documentation.
Thanks, Sam. Tom Linsmeyer.
Thanks, Marty. First of all, I find this conversation very, very positive. I think the success of our system requires coordinated efforts between the financial reporting standard setters, the auditors, and the auditing regulators and the securities regulators. And thinking holistically about how we make the system work together best is a very important thing that we should have been doing all along. And perhaps we've done it in fits and spurts, but if we could continue that I think is probably a very, very significant positive move forward. In terms of documentation, I agree with Sam. I don't see that the FASB has a role in prescribing preparer documentation. First of all, that preparer documentation isn't going to be used by us. It's going to be used by auditors and regulators. And I think that we would be woefully poor at thinking through how to do that well. But I also agree maybe it's not a role of the auditing standard setter, but I thought I was most encouraged to think about what Brian said, that there are securities laws that suggest that there are books and records that must be in place and that there's internal control documentation that must be in place for related to accounting. And that's an area I think we need to explore whether or not we could connect the dots better about what books and records and internal control documentation is necessary to be able to support financial reporting systems within our economy, because that may be the place where it rightfully resides. And then the ultimate regulator can end up making the judgments as to whether that's good or not in some of their enforcement activities and in coordination with the PCAOB. But that's not really for me to make a call about. A third observation. Sometimes we fall into the conversation as if uniformity is comparability. That is, if you account for a transaction identically everywhere, that leads to comparability. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. All transactions are not the same, and they do not have all the same economic roles within business models of companies. And so sometimes I think we have to be thinking about that there ought to be the ability to have judgments to create differences in how we measure or recognize certain things, even though they might be very similar transactions. And lastly, I want to react to Sam's sort of observation about fair value being necessarily less reliable. In some instances, I think that really is a challenge. But of course, if there's a fair value that you have an observable level one market price, there's no reliability issue there. And I think we have to think very carefully, back to the slide that's up here now, what our challenges are about fair values. Because in most fair value valuation models, you have to come up with cash flows, probability-weighted cash flows or cash flows. But we're seeing that required in an allocated historical cost model if we think about leases or revenue now. You've got to come up with discount rates in a fair value model, but that's going to be in an allocated historical cost model too. So what is the difference? I think the difference is our lack of familiarity or comfort with the model that you put the cash flows and the discount rates into, and whether or not we're selecting the best model. And where I think auditing guidance, where I look at the auditing standards or talking about auditing fair value, it doesn't precisely look at making judgments or evaluations as to whether the model that's being, the cash flows are being put into or the discounts are being put into, is the best model for capturing the economics of that transaction. So I would suggest at least thinking about whether specifically moving away from estimates and judgments that tend to look at inputs to models as to whether there ought to be something to think about judgments about models too.
Thanks, Tom. Next, Bill Gradison.
I just want to pick up on a point that Sam made. I've been trying over the years that I've been here to understand why we haven't been able to find more of a common ground with the other two standards writers in our auditing standards. It's a great disappointment to me that we have not. But in trying to understand why, if I'm right that that is the case, trying to understand why that is the case, I think it's that we're writing auditing standards that we can inspect against, which is a point that Sam, you didn't use those words, but I think that's kind of what he was saying. That's what came through to me. Now, nothing necessarily wrong with that, but if that's true, then I think it would be useful as part of this discussion, maybe now or another time, to really explore whether some of the basic assumptions that we've used in writing all of our auditing standards need to be reexamined in light of the change of direction of many of the key accounting standards and the greater range of judgment that's going to be involved. Because it seems to me that with the obvious and very important exception of making sure that there's adequate documentation of how the judgments were reached, that the inspectors aren't going to have a hell of a lot to do in applying our standards that we have today to this new world that is over which we have no control, which is moving ahead rather smartly, quickly.
Thank you, Bill. And we've Ian Dingwall, you've been waiting patiently, so you're next.
I'm a patient guy. As I heard, I've been listening to this discussion, you know, I guess I need to talk about my world a little bit. I think most of you deal with what I'll call the above-average auditor. I don't see always the above-average auditor. I see auditors that usually need a lot of guidance. And frankly, when I got my job many years ago now, it occurred to me that we really inherited an idea, and that was to put out for people who are auditing employee benefit plans an accounting and audit guide that basically brought together for people who are auditing plans both the accounting information and the auditing techniques that could be employed. And the guys that are out, I hope, auditing benefit plans today take the audit guide for auditing employee benefit plans as kind of their Bible. It's what they use day in and day out. Now, it's not their audit program. They develop their audit programs, you know, more specifically and tailored for re-engagement, we hope, although that doesn't always happen. But it does seem to me represent a great opportunity that the board has to put out more specific guidance that kind of brings us all together. Industry audit guides, I would hope that the board would give that some considerations. You know, there's no reason for every firm here to put together kind of a guide on how to audit broker-dealers. You know, perhaps the PCAOB could do this, and you would encourage uniformity among the firms in terms of what they do and what they consider as part of their work. So that's my pitch for industry audit guides.
Thank you. Next, Barbara Roper.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about this issue of judgment framework and why investor advocates tend to get a little nervous when we hear that conversation. And it has nothing to do with the benefits of a judgment framework per se. I mean, clearly there is a benefit to having a sensible, well-thought-out framework in which judgments are made. When we get nervous is when we hear what seems to be the inevitable second part of that process, which is, and you should respect those judgments. And the notion is, I mean, so the way it plays out then is you have the issuer, the future Enron or whatever, who says, this is my professional judgment. I followed an appropriate framework in reaching it, and you, the auditor, should respect that. And the future Arthur Andersen finds a way to get comfortable with that professional judgment and doesn't second-guess it because, after all, they also believe in not second-guessing professional judgments based on a framework. And they turn to the PCAOB and they say, this is my professional judgment, and I followed an appropriate framework in arriving at it, and you should respect that. And we heard it today. You know, the inspectors should respect those judgments. And I'm sorry, but I think the whole notion of skepticism is that you're supposed to question those judgments. You're not supposed to respect those judgments, and the regulators are supposed to question those judgments. That's why the PCAOB was created. And this seems to me to be headed down when not the notion of a framework per se, but the notion of a framework that we then take as either an implied or an explicit safe harbor is exactly the opposite direction of what Congress intended when it passed Sarbanes-Oxley and created this body.
Thanks, Barbara. Next, Mike Gallagher.
I just wanted to say a quick word about the staffing model. Marty, when you asked the question about the staffing model, it was really about relative mix, right? Partner, manager, and below. And why I believe that there won't be a massive change in the mix, I said that there might be some, and clearly significant judgments need to be made by the more senior members of the team. But for every judgment that's made, there's generally assumptions underlying the judgment, and there's facts underlying those assumptions, which will need to be audited, generally by the, you know, less experienced staff, and that's appropriate. So I think that the total hours, you know, may in fact go up. In fact, they probably will. If you think about how easy it is to look at an answer and find an answer, in a book versus everything that goes into a judgment. You know, the judgment generally takes longer. It's going to put pressure not only on auditors, but preparers. So just to, you know, clarify the remarks.
Thanks for that clarification. That's very helpful. Thank you. Jim Cox?
Yeah, I want to go back to this point. I think we're actually talking past each other. So the observation was made earlier that accounting standards should have within them auditable criteria. And I thought I heard Sam and Tom reject that notion. And I hope that that's just a misunderstanding. As you move from what may be generally referred to as rules-based to principles-based accounting, and you get into a range of much more estimates and assumptions and judgments, et cetera, that there needs to be something in the formulation of the accounting principles themselves, Tom, it seems to me, as to what is the fair areas for implementing these policies or these practices. And, I mean, it's not just going out and talking to three cab drivers, we all agree to that, about what the value is of your portfolio, okay? But there ought to be something, you know, that you could identify as to what would be reliable databases for, et cetera, for determining whether assets have been impaired or not. And that should be something that's part of the standard. And then that gets back to the question we've seen earlier about the necessity of the auditor sitting down and having this conversation with the CFO or other senior executives about exactly why there's a disagreement here and why the estimate is that they're being overly aggressive here and actually enter into impermissible bounds. So I think that there is something that the FASB has to be doing, and these things don't just get divided into little parts. Otherwise, as was wisely pointed out today, without that criteria in the standards themselves, then it's going to be very hard to audit around them.
Thanks for those comments. In the interest of time, if we could wrap up with the last comment on this first two topics with Doug Carmichael.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on the theme of the need for coordination. We don't have an internal control standard setter, and we probably don't need another standard setter. And that means that the existing bodies, the FASB and the PCAOB and the SEC and the AICPA, need to coordinate on whose standards will contain those requirements. I think it would be a huge mistake to get into a turf concern that would leave a void in the area. If we recognize the need for standards for documentation as things move ahead into more principles-based accounting judgments, then we should have a coordination. And I would hope that the FASB wouldn't categorically reject the need to include some documentation standards. I think a good model for the kind of thing needs to be done is probably SEC Staff Accounting Bulletin 102 on the relationship between the loan loss allowance and the need for documentation of the support of that number and documentation supporting the methodology to determine the loan loss allowance. That kind of guidance is needed. It's not needed just in the loan loss allowance area, but I picked that because I think it's a good example. It's a very difficult accounting measurement, and it points out the need for that additional guidance on what kind of documentation you do need. I think it would be feasible for the SEC, and if nobody else does it, the SEC is going to have to do it for public companies on filling this void in the need for guidance on documentation. However, I know we're concerned with public companies here, but there are a lot of private companies out there, and there are a lot of auditors that audit private companies, and they're going to be having to adhere to these same accounting standards with the same kind of problems. So if it's just the SEC that provides that guidance, that again will leave a void. So I believe that there's a need for a greater coordination. Generally, the auditing standards need to pick up and maybe pick up on the problems and get into other standard setters' turfs win because mostly the auditing standards come last. The accounting standards get set first, and the SEC guidance comes out first, and the auditing standards, in my estimation, then need to pick it up. But if that creates problems, then the answer is not to leave a void there so we preserve everybody's turf, but to coordinate in advance to make sure that the guidance, the standards, are there when they're needed and not passed up later.
Doug, I think your analogy was very good in terms of the importance of prepared documentation, and in one particular area that's very challenging, the loan loss allowance, and what's reasonable in that area is a very wide range of acceptability, and therefore, if we're prepared to document very specifically how they got to that allowance, I think that guidance is very helpful in that area, and I think it's very important, SAB 102. So I think your analogy, and then I think back to Wayne's comments before about the many judgments that have to be made in revenue recognition, and therefore the importance of similar type of guidance with respect to what kind of documentation would be expected around those judgments should be very helpful to the reliability of the financial preparation as well as to the ability to audit that. So good analogy, and I think it's a very good point. We started, Charlie, with you introducing this topic, and so why don't we end, Charlie, with you closing it out.
Thanks, Marty. Arch, I think, rightfully pointed out the issue of risk tolerance. I think it's something that's kind of maybe lost in our discussion today, but over half our population is invested in the market. Many of those people fall in the baby boomer category. At the same time that we're asking for investors and regulators to be more tolerant, the truth is many of the investors are actually having less tolerance for risk. And I think we're going to be basically doing something that's close to jumping out of an airplane. It's fine to jump out of an airplane when you have a parachute. It's another thing to jump out of the airplane and then try to build the parachute. So I think it's just incumbent upon all of us to really think through these issues and make sure that we actually have a good plan in place before we implement some of these standards.
Thanks, Charlie, and thanks, Tony and Barbara. I think at this point in time we have gotten great input with respect to this topic. I think we've learned a lot from everybody's views. We're a little bit behind schedule. I think we're scheduled for a break at 10:30, so why don't we do that at now, and let's try to be back at 11 o'clock. Thank you.
Hello?
We'll be continuing momentarily.
Okay.
I want to thank everybody for your participation in that last discussion. To us, it's a very, very important discussion, and Tom Linsmeyer and I had a chance to chat during the coffee break, and whether you consider removing from a rules-based to a principles-based, I don't think is the major point. We're changing the framework to a very large degree, and I think dialogue of this type, which includes the FASB and the PCAOB, hearing the views together, of people around this table is beneficial to both parties and very important to, for us to continue the dialogue, the PCAOB and FASB and SEC together as the framework changes. So this is a, it was a very important topic, and I appreciate the tremendous amount of input on the topic. On the next topic, we're discussing rulemaking on failure to supervise. And Bella Rivshin, our Associate Chief Auditor, and Michael Stevenson, Deputy General Counsel, will lead that discussion. But to kick off the discussion, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Steve Harris to begin. Thanks, Steve.
Well, thank you, Marty, and I want to preemptively thank everybody for their very active discussion on this topic to come as well. So we're looking forward to your active engagement on it. This is not a new topic. Members of the SAG first discussed the auditor's responsibility to supervise on February 27, 2008, and a number of you I know were present at that meeting. During today's discussion, we are seeking your views specifically on the board's August 5, 2010 release relating to the application of the failure to supervise provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. The release addresses two critically important objectives. The first is to remind auditors that the board has the authority and will use it to take disciplinary action against a registered public accounting firm or its supervisory personnel where appropriate for a failure to supervise. The second objective is to solicit, to solicit comment on specific concepts for developing a rulemaking proposal that could lead to a firm's documenting the supervision responsibilities related to each audit from the first line supervisor for each part of an audit all the way to the responsibilities of the managing partner of the firm. This objective in particular is what we would like to discuss today. Since coming to the board in June 2008, I have been struck by the volume, and this is meant to be a deliberately broad statement, of supervisory concerns brought to our attention by our inspection division. For example, in the board's December 2008 report on large firm inspections, the board identified inadequate supervision and review as an important factor that allowed audit deficiencies to occur. In addition to questions about the supervision review activities of engagement managers and partners, the board identified supervision-related concerns in several other areas, including partner evaluation and compensation processes, concurring review policies and procedures, internal inspection programs, and the evaluation, supervision, and control of work performed by foreign affiliates. As the release states, the board is therefore considering proposing rules requiring firms to make and document clear assignments of relevant supervision responsibilities throughout the firm. The board is considering whether such rules would serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing clarity about who within the firm is accountable for various supervisory responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. The comment period on the board's release will remain open until November 3rd, and we encourage you to submit written comments on the potential rulemaking concepts. We are especially interested in hearing how investors, audit committee members, and others who rely upon audited financial statements view the importance of clearly defined and documented supervisory responsibility at accounting firms. At this time, I will turn the floor over to Michael Stevenson and Bella Rivshin, who will provide additional information regarding the board's application of the failure to supervise provision and moderate today's discussion on the potential rulemaking concepts.
Thank you, Steve. As Steve noted, Steve described the two prongs of the August 5th release. I'm going to provide brief background on the first point, the first piece of it, relating to the scope or potential application of Section 105C6 of the Act, as described by the board in the release. And Bella will discuss the second point, the rulemaking concept portion of the release, with respect to which the board is seeking public comment and seeking your input today. Under Section 105C6 of the Act, if an associated person of a registered public accounting firm violates any provision of law, rules, or standards referenced there in the Act, the board may, in addition to imposing sanctions on the person who commits the violation, impose sanctions on other individuals or the firm if the board finds that there was a failure reasonably to supervise that associated person. Specifically, Section 105(c)(6) provides that the board may impose sanctions on a registered firm or a, quote, supervisory person, close quote, of the firm if an associated person of the firm commits certain violations, which I'll refer to as predicate violations, and the firm has failed reasonably to supervise that person either as required by the rules of the board relating to auditing or quality control standards or otherwise, with a view to preventing such violations. You can see that there are two distinct bases there. Failure reasonably to supervise as required by rules or standards, what I'll refer to as the rules clause of the section, and a failure otherwise to reasonably supervise, what I'll call the or otherwise clause. In isolation, the rules clause of Section 105(c)(6) would be essentially redundant of authority provided to the board elsewhere in the Act. That is, to the extent the board adopts rules or standards related to supervision, the sanctioning authority provided through the rules clause of Section 105(c)(6) overlaps with the board's separate broad authority to impose sanctions for violations of rules and standards as provided in a different section of the Act. On the other hand, the range of conduct that the board might address through the or otherwise clause encompasses conduct not covered by specific supervision rules or standards. For conduct in this category, the board's authority to impose sanctions is found only in Section 105(c)(6) and would involve case-by-case determinations concerning the reasonableness of supervision in particular circumstances without regard to whether any specific supervision rules or standards are implicated. And this is probably a good point to mention that the Senate report on the Act describes Section 105(c)(6) as intended to provide for liability on terms that are similar to those that apply to broker-dealers under the Exchange Act. Those Exchange Act provisions do not limit their application to circumstances involving violations of specific supervision rules. And in that sense, the or otherwise clause in Section 105(c)(6) helps to fulfill the intent described in the Senate report. The release also discusses the scope of persons who might be subject to sanctions under Section 105(c)(6). The Act provides that the board may impose sanctions on a firm or upon a supervisory person of a firm. The question arises how, if at all, that limits the universe of associated persons whom the board may sanction for failure to supervise. To the extent that board auditing standards prescribe supervision obligations for any specified category of individuals, they're essentially limited to obligations imposed on members of the audit engagement team. The reach of Section 105(c)(6), though, is not limited in that way. Nor does anything in Section 105(c)(6) indicate that the term supervisory person limits that section's reach to those with direct and immediate supervisory responsibility for the associated person who commits a violation. Any associated person in the firm, including even the most senior personnel of very large firms, could be a supervisory person for Section 105(c)(6) purposes, depending upon the nature of his or her responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to the conduct of the associated person who commits a predicate violation. That said, it does not follow that each person with such responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to a particular violation could be sanctioned merely because the predicate violation occurred. The release describes the board's view that Section 105(c)(6) sanctions would be appropriate only where, in relation to the predicate violation, there has been a failure to exercise such responsibility, ability, or authority reasonably. Another significant scope question relates to identifying areas of responsibility that can be understood as involving responsibility to supervise in the sense that makes the conduct reachable through Section 105(c)(6). Some supervision responsibilities are rooted in certain board auditing standards. For example, AU Section 311 and its board-adopted successor on supervision, AS Number 10, impose certain obligations on the engagement partner to supervise the work performed on a particular audit. Additional supervision responsibilities are rooted in the board's quality control standards. The introduction to those standards notes that they relate to quality control procedures to ensure that services are, quote, competently delivered and adequately supervised, close quote. QC standards broadly define a system of quality control as a process to provide the firm with reasonable assurance that its personnel comply with applicable professional standards and the firm's standards of quality. QC standards include a section on monitoring a firm's audit practice and include a section on a firm's responsibilities related to staffing audits, particularly the firm's responsibilities concerning the competencies of the practitioner in charge of an audit. Associated persons who have responsibilities related to implementation of components of those categories, whether broadly or with respect to only a portion of the firm's audit practice, have responsibilities that, depending on the facts and circumstances, could be understood as supervision responsibilities in relation to an individual associated person. Whether the connection between particular unreasonable supervisory conduct and a particular predicate violation is sufficient to warrant sanctions under Section 105(c)(6) will depend on the specific facts and circumstances. But as a general matter, as the board described in the release, individuals' responsibilities for implementing a firm's QC policies and procedures are responsibilities that relate to supervision, and given a sufficient connection to a predicate violation, unreasonably carrying out those responsibilities could result in sanctions for failure to supervise. The release also recognizes that Section 105(c)(6) does not create any form of strict failure to supervise liability for the firm or supervisory personnel just because an associated person commits a violation. Section 105(c)(6) provides the possibility of an affirmative defense that could preclude the board from imposing sanctions against a supervisory person for failure to supervise. That section provides that no supervisory person can be found to have failed reasonably to supervise if the individual reasonably discharged the supervisory duties placed on him or her by the firm's procedures, and the individual had no reasonable cause to believe the firm's procedures were not being complied with, and the firm's procedures comply with applicable board rules and would reasonably be expected to prevent and detect the violation. That's a short overview of the part one of the August 5th release. And before I turn things over to Bella, I just wanted to highlight that, as explained in the release and is reiterated by Steve, the board has not in the release sought comment on the points I've been describing. Rather, the release expresses the view that debate about those points is more appropriately suited to take place in the context of the board's application of them in concrete situations. The release does, however, seek comment on conceptual approaches to rules to achieve a specific end, increasing clarity about who within a firm is accountable for various responsibilities that bear on the quality of audits. And for more on that, I'll now turn it over to Bella.
Thank you, Michael. Now I'd like to discuss the solicitation of comments on the rulemaking concepts. The PCAOB staff, through inspections and enforcement, at times has observed that the quality of supervision within a firm was affected by the lack of clarity regarding the allocation of various supervisory responsibilities at different levels within the firm's practice. The staff believe that the rules requiring the firm to make and document clear assignments of responsibility for implementing the necessary quality control policies and procedures could help avoid potential confusion within a firm about where the significant responsibility rests, the confusion that could potentially lead to gaps in supervision with consequent violations of the professional standards. In addition, the staff believe rules could facilitate the PCOB's assessment through the inspection process of a firm's supervisory practices. The potential rules could also facilitate identifying, after a predicate violation has occurred, the persons with relevant supervision responsibilities. The types of rules the staff is considering would not create new supervision responsibilities, but would only address how clearly the firms assign responsibilities that are clearly already required to be part of the audit, any audit practice. The potential rulemaking would be in addition to the board's current quality control standards, QC 20, 30, and 40. The staff has preliminarily considered how such a rule might be crafted. The concept release outlines two potential approaches, a general and a more detailed approach. One possibility is to formulate a rule that only in the general terms requires assignment of responsibility and documentation of that assignment. Under this approach, a rule could build on the existing requirement that responsibility for the design and maintenance of the quality control policy and the procedures be assigned to appropriate individuals and could require firms to document all such specific assignments sufficient to cover the full range of the firm's obligation under the quality control standards and to assign to other associated persons any appropriate higher level supervisory responsibilities over those persons. In other words, if a firm complied with the rule, it could be possible to identify, with respect to a particular violation and an audit, any individuals who had responsibility for any aspects of the quality control system that failed, and to identify other individuals with supervisory responsibility for those individuals' performance relating to the quality control system. Another approach could involve a more detailed formulation. Under this approach, a rule could identify and define various specific areas of supervisory responsibility and could require a firm to assign responsibility in each area to specifically identified individuals. The areas of supervisory responsibility identified in a more detailed approach could be derived from the board's quality control standards. The potential benefit of a more detailed approach would not be to encompass more or different areas of supervisory responsibility than the general approach, but would just be to make more concrete the scope of the rule's requirements, so to reduce a risk posed by the general approach, that a firm might think that it has covered the relevant range of responsibilities, only to have the board identify a gap in the firm's assignments. The staff believes that the firm could have some flexibility in the aspects of how it approaches compliance and with the potential rule under either potential approach. Now, the previous discussion on the FASB and the ISB accounting standards was very lively, and I hope you saved some of that energy and thoughts for this topic, because we would really like to hear some of your thoughts. And to start off the discussion, the staff is interested in obtaining feedback on whether such potential rules would serve to further the public interest and protect investors by increasing the clarity about who within the firm is accountable for the various responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. Also, the staff is interested in hearing from investors, audit committees, and others who rely on the audited financial statements, view the importance of the clearly defined documented supervisory responsibilities in the accounting firms. And now I'll turn it over to start the discussion. Barbara Roper?
What the heck, since nobody's jumping in, I'll start. I'm a strong supporter of having clear suitability standards in this area. I think it benefits everybody. My guess is, not knowing everything about how this works in the audit firm context, my guess is that there are some areas where supervisory responsibility is already clearly defined and clearly understood, and other areas, particularly within broader networks of the larger organization, where there is less clarity. And so I do think there's a benefit to having a rule that requires clear documentation, definition and documentation of the entire, chain of command of responsibility, and I think it needs to track up through the entire organization. I think some of the benefits, I think it focuses the mind of the individual who has that responsibility if it's absolutely clear that they're the one holding the bag at the end of the day. I think it gives the board something to inspect against. In terms of whether people are adequately performing their supervisory obligations. And in worst case scenario, I think it can be the basis of enforcement actions, all of which I think have the potential to drive audit quality. I don't have a strong opinion about the benefits of a more general versus detailed approach. my guess is there's some middle ground there that, you know, maybe defines general areas that have to be covered by this, but it doesn't need necessarily to be too prescriptive. The more prescriptive it is, the less scalable it is. The more prescriptive it is, the more tendency there is to think it defines the scope of the requirement, so, you know, less ability to adjust and adapt it to different firm models. And I think the board has an effective mechanism if it will use it to require adjustments if it sees problems, which is, you know, the ability to require remediation based on inspections creates that interplay between the firms and the boards that can drive this, you know, if there are inadequacies in the approach, can drive it in the desired direction. You know, obviously that, particularly in the early days, that should be not in a sort of gotcha approach, but in a, you know, look, good first effort, we think there needs to be something more robust in this area or whatnot, let's drive that conduct and then, you know, use that as the basis for strengthening the requirements.
Thank you, Barbara. Arch?
Well, from my standpoint, I don't think you can overstate the importance of supervisory responsibilities. And then when I think about the years I've been dealing with our quality control system, some of the things you've indicated in here, it strikes me it really fits best into all your efforts that are going on with the QC standards and to embed it in those standards. As Barbara indicated, I think if you try and get too prescriptive with this, it doesn't fit the wide range of firms that are going to have to be trying to implement it. You know, we certainly our people need, and so in our documented quality control, we lay out who has what responsibilities in what areas, and we're always looking at that from a standpoint of how do we improve it? Do we need to change it as things might change? And it's engagement level, it's client acceptance, it covers all of the different areas of the quality control system, and so that's why I just thought it would fit best in that effort rather than something separate.
Just to follow up, Arch, if I understood what you were saying, it sounded like in your firm you believe you follow sort of the general approach already, but for each area of responsibility that would be described in the QC standards, there is somebody, a person, who's identified with that responsibility. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, I wouldn't say by name because obviously people change over time, but positions, yes, in terms of client acceptance, good example. I mean, we have, depending on the nature of the client, certain factors that we take into consideration, our levels of client acceptance, who has to be involved with the approval of a new client, goes up the chain, so to speak. And so the positions are described as to how that is to take place.
Thanks.
Arch. Mary Hartman Morris.
Thank you, Bella. I just wanted to add to that. I agree with both Barbara and Arch on the requirements, and I agree it probably shouldn't be too prescriptive. I think it should be up to the audit firms. But I think that one point I wanted to make sure that was pointed out, the ACAP recommendation, and it really does tie into some of the key indicators of audit quality. So I think this is just one more step towards doing that. So the firms, you know, they would document necessarily, you know, who would be responsible for certain assignments. But it would be maybe eventually tied to some of their key performance indicators of quality and the training and individuals that are involved in the actual reviews. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Wayne Collins.
Yeah, I guess this is a less contentious than the earlier discussion. I also agree with the general nature of how the guidance should be couched and that it should be incorporated in the quality control standards. I think one thing is essential is that there needs to be some kind of a clear delineation or a clear understanding of what constitutes supervisory personnel versus management personnel. I think that would be certainly something that firms with their various structures would need to be able to know who fits within this particular part of the standard.
Wayne, could you elaborate a little bit in terms of the
supervisory personnel versus the management personnel? Are we talking about kind of the management of the firm and how those individuals
yes.
may never go to a supervisory level if you drill down all the way down to the engagement partner?
Yeah, I guess you're looking at what is their role in the firm and you know what aspect of their role might touch on the conduct of an audit and how they might affect the conduct of an audit and how indirect does it have to get before they ultimately do, because you have people whose primary responsibilities are operational in nature, but within those operations there may be evaluation of personnel, and it's sometimes hard to make a clear distinction between operations responsibilities and supervision responsibilities, and I think that has to be thought out some more before the guidance is promulgated.
Thank you. Steve Rafferty.
Thank you. I had, honestly, a little trouble understanding the issue here, because if you just say failure to supervise, that's a fairly broad category of issues. It would be helpful to me to know more specifics about what the observations were from the inspections. What were the actual findings and the problems in the audit? Were they failure to review the work or something else? And I would tend to question then whether I have a hard time believing in most cases that there's really a lack of clarity as opposed to a failure to execute. And if it's a failure for people to do their jobs, which they ought to understand to begin with, then I would tend to agree with perhaps where Arch was going, which was this is really part of the quality control system, and are there adequate hooks and tools and checks and balances in the quality control system to ensure that people do what they already know that they're required to do.
Thank you, Steve. Jim Cox.
The name John Goodfriend is famous in history for two reasons. One, he was the character in Tom Wolfe's novel, The Lion, the other one is that he was CEO of Salomon Brothers during the bond squeeze by a person who later had a prime role, poster child role, in a long-term capital. The reason I bring that up is that as you draft this rule and you think about specificity versus non-specificity and going either way and what you mean by supervisors, the leading authority in securities law is the John Goodfriend decision, which was an SEC decision that sets forth its thinking about what makes one a supervisor. And it went through a whole cast of characters, which includes, by the way, the general counsel of Salomon Brothers. And the SEC goes to great lengths to say that you're not a supervisor merely because the compliance office is run out of the general counsel's office, but because of the level of involvement with the general counsel, Salomon Brothers, in the conversations about what to do about this character that was manipulating the treasury bond market, a bidding process. And so I think that should be instructive to you just going forward as to at least what one regulator thinks the meaning of supervision means and what qualifies one as a supervisor.
Thank you, Jim. Lynn Turner?
I think you have to think in broad terms when you talk about supervision. The tone at the top takes you right to the very top, and we've heard people say how tone at the top is so important in companies, and it's no different for the accounting firms. And we've seen a number of cases, Xerox, Parmalat, Enron, where people right up to the very most senior level in those firms were involved in critical and key decisions. So I don't believe a narrow definition of a supervisor is functional or will work. It will isolate the very people at the top who are so key to making sure that people have got the right mindset from any responsibility, and I don't think that's a direction you want to go in as well. I would also say, though, probably much more effective than any rulemaking in this area, which may be necessary, I don't set that aside, though, is a couple really good enforcement actions. If you found problems with people failing to supervise, then let's see the actions. I understand you've got this problem with these things staying private and people litigating. But let's, if you've got a problem, you think it's a serious problem, let's see some of these enforcement actions and bring actions against a couple of these people, because I think that will do more to cause people in the field to actually start doing their job and supervising, to Steve's point, than will all the regulations you can possibly write. If people know they're going to be held accountable for supervising, I think that'll be great. But we've had rules for a long time that have said, you know, you're supposed to supervise and stay on top of these people. I can't imagine not a partner that doesn't understand that today. And so if there's a breakdown down at the partner level, that person is the one ultimately accountable. And there's nothing like a good old couple of good-fashioned enforcement actions whacking those people really good to wake everyone up and improve performance.
Thank you, Lynn. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, I agree very much with what Lynn just said about the need for enforcement actions. Yesterday I mentioned the large firm report that Levitt did during the early 1990s, looking at the nine largest broker-dealer firms. And the issue there, again, was that there had been reports that the major broker-dealer firms were hiring individual registered reps with long records of customer abuses, and that those individuals were able to stay in the firm and continue to pile up additional customer abuses within firms that were supposed to have good, strong procedures in place to prevent that sort of thing. And what Chairman Levitt did with that report was to basically say one of the responses that we're making to this is going to be to put a much greater emphasis on failure to supervise. In other words, we're going to recognize this is not just an issue of bad apples. These are firms that are tolerating this conduct, and we're going to hold people accountable up the chain for the decisions that allow that to happen, and that is going to inform the way we approach enforcement in this area. He announced it, everybody's on notice, and then, you know, you proceed with that approach. And I think that's key. I also think this is, you know, not to beat a dead horse, increasingly important as we move into an area where we're dealing with more judgments. You know, the type of issues we've talked about, you know, related to the need to get more documentation, the need to be looking beyond just collaborating information that collaborates management decision, you know, the need to have adequate procedures in place to gather outside information that informs the audit. Those are issues that, for which I can see the firm, you know, the culture that the firm sets, the expectations that they set, the guidance that they provide is going to drive partner conduct, and holding people accountable up the chain for the way they guide partner conduct, I think, will be helpful if we're going to have a chance of having, you know, the kind of audits that really hold the line and enforce the standards within a vaguer, less enforceable rule construct.
Thanks, Barbara. I wanted to follow up on one thing, and Lynn had said something which I just wanted to, again, Wayne, go back to the comment you made, just so I understand the point again, because it wasn't clear to me yet. Making a distinction between management and supervisory personnel, and I think Lynn had talked about, you know, going right to the top of the organization, the person who sets the tone at the top. I guess that could be management, the CEO of the firm, and his responsibility could be P&L. You know, just for instance, you know, just is in charge of the profitability of the firm. But that still could have a supervisory aspect with respect to the partners who lead the practice in auditing in terms of their behavior with respect to audit quality or sufficiency if they felt they had to deliver profits at a cost of
getting all the work done potentially. Is there a distinction that maybe I'm still missing?
Yeah, it wasn't so much the position that the person has, but the responsibilities that the person has. So, you know, that same person could have management responsibilities and supervisory responsibilities, and some of the what that person perceives as management responsibilities can have an indirect association to the quality of the audit when it comes to hiring personnel, for example, with a background that Barbara had mentioned.
Doug Anderson.
I only just had a quick comment. I'm kind of torn on this one because, in general, I don't like overly prescriptive standards or rules. And in that sense, if it comes to the question of having a specific, either detailed standard or general standard, I'd lean towards a general standard so you don't end up with a checklist standard, which doesn't require auditors to use good judgment. But I wanted to follow up on something Steve had mentioned, and as I got thinking about this during the discussion here, this is a pretty broad topic as to failure to supervise. And if one of the motivations behind this effort is because of the results of the inspection process, I'd encourage the PCAOB to find a way to get something like the report that we talked about yesterday on what we saw in the inspections on the audit firms dealing with the economic crisis. If this is a big enough issue, it's driving potential rulemaking. If we could get more clarity on the specific kinds of things that we're seeing in the inspections, what part of that broad spectrum of fail to supervise are you seeing? That might help not only guide the rulemaking process, but guide all the firms to know where they should be worrying about or concerned about the weakness areas that are in other firms that may be infecting their firm.
Thank you, Doug. One of the things the concept release also seeks comment on are the potential unintended consequences if a board were to go down a path of potential rulemaking in this area, and that's broad to either the general or the specific approach. Wanted to pose this question to the SAG in case you had any thoughts about any potential unintended consequences. Barbara Roper.
The only thing I'd say briefly is, and the reason I think it's important to, as I say, to follow the chain of responsibility up the ladder, is that if you're within a firm, this is common in the broker-dealer world, which is the primary area where I dealt with this. As I said, in the large firm report, more than 80% of the violations were in one company. So if you're in a company that compensates and promotes and does evaluations and everything to encourage an approach that's not in the investor interest, the fact that there's a person named on a chart as being responsible for one particular area shouldn't leave them holding the bag for what's created, a culture that's created within the corporation. And so I think I don't see this as a downside to having failure to supervise responsibility. I think it's a caution to make sure that in developing that, it goes all the way to up the ladder.
Thank you, Barbara. Bill Gradison.
For the record, the largest monetary sanction that has ever been imposed by this board so far was in connection with a failure to supervise. It was $1 million, and it was levied against one of the biggest firms. I only mention that because some of the discussion a little while ago might have given the impression that nothing is going on in the enforcement area with regard to failure to supervise. At least there was that one back in December of 2008, and that does lead me to a question. In view of that enforcement action, which is public information, what would a rule add that beyond the precedent already set by that sanction?
I think what the board's release tries to make clear that rule is not necessarily necessary to impose sanctions for failure to supervise. And I think in the case you're referring to wasn't even under 105C6, but related to specific failures to do things required cited in the standards. So there's no obstacle. You're absolutely right. There's no obstacle to the board bringing more enforcement actions like that. The point of the type of rule we're talking about today would be to see whether there are ways that a rule could supplement that authority, could be helpful both to the board in identifying where responsibility lies for failure, and also by increasing accountability through the same mechanism to actually increase the quality of supervision and increase the quality of audits.
Doug Anderson? Well, then Lynn Turner.
Bill, on that particular case, that case, that fine, and I'm sure the firm considered it serious, but that fine was half of 1% of that firm's revenues. I don't know that I consider that something that is really going to shake people up and take notice. It's almost like a cost of operation. I think if you want to get serious about what is if you see a case and if you thought it was all that serious, a fine of that magnitude may not get it done. The law specifically says you could have fined up to $15 million and you chose instead to fine less than 10% of what you are allowed to under the law to fine. There's another message that could be sent by that as well, and that is, you didn't think it was that significant or that serious, or you would have used a much higher fine. So I do think coming back and sending a stronger message in the enforcement cases would be helpful. I personally think that, to your point, I think that'll probably do better than a rule. But, by God, if you need to go back and tell people one more time, they really need to do their jobs as partners and get it done. There's nothing like a good old-fashioned $15 million enforcement case and find that audit partner up to the full max you can. Of $750,000 per occurrence, you take, a whack at a partner's personal pocketbook, and personally, in these cases, I think in most of these cases, we're going to find had nothing to do with the national office, had nothing to do with the CEO at the top. It was essentially down at the individual partner where they didn't perform in accordance with the firm standards. That's been my experience. It hadn't been a firm-wide failure to supervise. It's been on down with that individual partner, and there's nothing like taking those out. And if you found one that failed to supervise on, say, three situations, go find them $2 million. That'll do more good than any rule you can ever write. But you got to get serious about the fine. Half of 1%, and less than 10% of what you could have fined the firm doesn't send a strong message.
Thank you, Lynn. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the rule you're talking about here is not to restate the obligation to supervise. The rule that you're talking about is to fully and carefully document where the obligation to supervise resides in different areas. And what that adds beyond enforcement is clarity. We eliminate any ambiguity about where it gives you something to inspect against, because strong as we are in supporting enforcement, we like to avoid the situations where we need enforcement as the response. And you have a great mechanism through the inspection and required remediation
to correct problems before they blow up into something where we'd want an enforcement action as a result. And so I think something that provides clarity in terms of documenting throughout, you know, the various different possible complex areas where the line of responsibility lies, gives the board something to inspect against that has the potential to strengthen those supervisory practices within the firms, particularly in the areas where they're not as clearly defined as they may be within the context of a particular audit. And then I would add, you know, about this notion that it's generally the audit partner. You know, I'm not sure the Arthur Andersen case actually supports that. That notion, you know, my memory is getting a little hazy, but as I recall on the Enron audit, there was a meeting with the risk committee within the firm in which the partners came in and identified, carefully walked through all of the risks associated with audit and all of the concerns about the accounting that they were presenting, and, you know, and then everybody found a way to get comfortable with that situation. Well, in that case, it's not just the partner who's doing the audit, although obviously they have a clear responsibility, but it's the other people within the firm who enabled that conduct. And so I do think that taking those supervision obligations beyond the sort of narrow construct of the audit, in which I think they're fairly clearly understood, into this broader issue of the management and operation of the firm is important.
Jim Cox?
I wonder if a byproduct of identifying, being specific where the duty resides, would also come up in the context of the minimizing the opportunities for being second-guessed by the SEC in its evaluation about whether the enforcement action is appropriate or not. So I just wonder if that clarity on that front wouldn't be helpful as well.
Jim, Lynn Turner?
Yeah, I don't want to oppose rules. I think some guidance here is helpful, including at the top. Barb is right about Enron. Xerox had top people at the right up to the CEO of the firm involved in that situation. Again, people at the senior level at Parmalat, including in the general counsel's office, were involved with those decisions. The court documents all clearly show that and establish that. So having the guidance that Barb talked about who's responsible, so you got something to inspect against and hold people accountable, that is clear, I think is fine. But then, unless you hold them accountable for what you write, it won't matter. So go get yourself some good general guidance that you inspect and hold them accountable against if you don't think what is out there now is adequate. And that's what's showing. But then you've also got to come through with some serious enforcement, or the rule means nothing.
Dan?
Maybe just a clarification, and Michael, if you think I'm off track here, tell me. But I mean, Bill raised the case where we have an action against the firm, and then in that case there's also an action against the engagement partner on the particular engagement. The theory against the firm is that they hadn't complied with the QC obligations to staff that engagement properly because of problems they were aware of with respect to the partner. And I think in that kind of case, people might ask, well, weren't there other individuals at the firm beyond the engagement partner who had some responsibility to make sure that those QC requirements were operating? But it is, well, speaking of that case particularly, it's difficult often to identify who those people are in a way that is really can serve as a basis for an enforcement action. So that's the reason for this concept, really, is to ask, should we make the firms define for us in advance who has these responsibilities so that if something, you know, falls apart, something goes wrong, we can identify the people who are responsible above the engagement level for the fact that the particular QC requirements didn't didn't operate or weren't enforced or whatever. So I'm just kind of responding to your point, Lynn. You can argue about the size of the fine and maybe the case should have been done differently. But what this proposal aims at is, well, are there other people in the firm hierarchy that should also be held responsible, and how do we identify those people?
And if you lay that out, I think that's fine, Dan. I'm a little bit surprised that people are coming back to you and maybe the firms around the table could respond to this, but I'm surprised that they would come back to you and say, we don't know who's responsible for supervising that partner and the quality on that audit. Obviously, you've got a concurring partner on each audit that's involved. And then you've got, whenever I've seen it, there's been a very clear delineation of who the partners report up to, and they may report up to a couple people depending upon the situation. But I think if people are saying we don't know who's supervising in the firm, we've got a huge problem. You know, if a firm's giving you that answer, right, you got a much bigger problem, and $1 million doesn't touch that problem. I mean, but that's what I'm hearing you're saying. You're saying that in these audits, people at the firm are coming back and telling you, we can't tell who was responsible for overseeing the audit partner and the quality on a particular audit. And I find that very disconcerting, and I'd like to hear the response of the other six firms around the table as to whether or not they really think in their firms they can't tell you who's responsible for overseeing the audit partner and supervising to make sure there's quality on an audit.
Sam Renzillo?
Just thinking about putting it up, but I guess I do now. Thanks, Bella.
You have to actually thank John White, who complained yesterday that he didn't get a chance to make a comment because wasn't fast enough.
Two of my favorite people. Lynn, I'm not sure what you mean by supervise the audit partner. I think that there are certain aspects of engagement overall, so if we're going to take this from engagement quality now and individual engagement quality and map that up against the QC standards, I would say there are a number of different people that touch certain aspects of that engagement to assure, to provide reasonable assurance that the team overall complies with the standards. And I'm not trying to be cute, but there's a particular individual or individuals that might say, this is the right person for engagement X because they've got the right skill set, whatever criteria you go through. There might be other people in conjunction with that that also says, client X is a client that we're willing to accept or continue to perform as their auditors. There might be another individual that is responsible for the first line of consultation with respect to a technical issue. So you get the client in the door, you get the right people on it, and then you've got a question and you say, okay, well, how is the QC system designed so that if there are consultations, it gets to the right place. And each firm has a different structure, whether it's regional, local, national. But you need that, right? So that the engagement partner says, I know where to go for a particular issue. Is there one per? I don't think there is just one person lined up in our firm to deal with each engagement partner. I think there are steps in the quality control system that are designed to have oversight at probably multiple levels. I don't know if that helps or not.
No, it does, Sam, but I think back to the question that Bill raised, which was a very valid and good question, I think what you just said absolutely and very strongly makes the case for Marty and his staff to move forward with rulemaking, because I think that notion of that broad a level of supervision does need to be defined and encompassed in what the rules define as supervision, as Dan just said, because I don't think, when I read through the current quality control rules, they're even close to being that broad or really address very adequately that situation. So I think, given what you just said, I think it makes an extremely strong case for the board to move ahead with rulemaking and define it in that broad a context. It's not a narrow context whatsoever then.
Mike Gallagher?
Yeah, just picking up on what Sam said, you know, it really is fact dependent, right, on if you have a bust. You know, some cases it's the audit partner didn't perform, and every piece of the system may have functioned perfectly, but that audit partner didn't perform. So maybe getting back to unintended consequences, that, you know, while you certainly should pry apart what happened, and if the implications, you know, go beyond the audit partner, you know, to some of the things that Sam talked about, you know, did you have a partner that was overloaded, or you had a partner that didn't have the right experience? Well, how did that partner find him or herself on that engagement? Right? How did they come to be? Did they get the right support from a concurring partner? I think those are reasonable questions to ask, but sometimes it just falls to the partner and a lack of performance. So, you know, the only caution I have in this whole thing, because I'm not troubled, quite frankly, about the standard. I think you probably have the authority under what exists today, but if you want to add it, I think that's fine. I would also opt for the more general rather than the specific, because I think it will be more scalable. But, you know, my only caution is not every single failure goes beyond the audit partner. And so this hopefully won't be an effort to let's see how many scalps we can get at the firms every time something goes wrong.
Michael, I think I'm going to have the same question Dan had. Stop me if I'm wrong. But I don't think we're saying that it would necessarily go above the partner when something went wrong if people above the partner did not fail to supervise reasonably. So you'd go beyond them if they failed to supervise reasonably, if they knew that there was a defect in the partner's skill set, for instance, as opposed to the situation where he or she was perfectly suited for the engagement, but quite frankly, to nobody's knowledge, he just didn't do what was expected of him or her. Is that fair? Thanks.
Sam Renzillo?
Again, I was trying to answer Lynn's question, but as to my own view, I think we're supportive of your, well, we are. I am supportive of the objective that you're trying to achieve. I'm also would support a more general approach as opposed to the detailed approach. The only question I have is, it seems to me that this ought to be baked in to what you're doing on the QC element, and it should be a part of that rulemaking and not necessarily separate rulemaking, although I guess I appreciate, maybe I don't appreciate, but there might be some piece of it that gets into rules versus the QC standards, and maybe different elements of the rules, but it would seem to me that it all ought to be done in conjunction with your current project on QC.
They're certainly related.
Arch?
Some of the discussion raised a question in my mind in terms of, you know, what do you mean by supervisory person? Because is somebody that is involved with responding to a consultation, as Sam was reflecting there, is that considered to be a supervisor of the engagement partner? And I think it may go back to something that Wayne was referring to, because there are a lot of people that touch engagements from the time they start coming in the door until reports go out. And which of those individuals are viewed as supervisory personnel? It's not like the partner. I mean, you have a big difference at the partner's level versus a partner supervising the work of the staff, because there's such a broad range of issues that can come up. So that might be something to take a look at in terms of clarity of definitions.
Sarge, we'll consider that. Galen Hansen.
Yeah, I'd like to basically agree with Sam. I think that this does need to be baked into the QC standards, but if you recall, in going back to our conversation yesterday, if that's the case, then there needs to be some minimum standards within the QC guidelines, not just, you know, broad guidance, you should do this, you should do that, but not really a requirement to do anything. There has to be some minimum QC standards. And then as to Arch's comments a minute ago, what do you mean by supervising? And a lot of people touch these engagements. I absolutely believe that. There's instances where maybe it's not a technical auditing or accounting matter, but it could even be independence. So who is signed off on independence if it's a complex technical issue? And these firms, I mean, internally, they know who's responsible within the organization, and there are those lines of authority and so forth. Those have to be documented somehow in the QC document as to what, you know, who says this is okay. And if that's addressed in the QC document, it shouldn't be all that tough to identify who is responsible. But the problem with all of this, I think, is getting back to the unintended consequences, because if what you could do is really set yourself up for somebody trying to obfuscate or blur those lines of authority so that it is not clear.
Thank you very much, Galen. And thank you, everyone on the SAG, for your very thoughtful comments. I have to say that, Steve Harris, would you like to make a statement?
We've heard from both Steve and Doug in terms of what we're actually finding. And I think we probably should take that under advisement and figure out, you know, how to get back to you. I mentioned in my statement that this comes up in virtually a significant volume of the inspection reports that I've read. And therefore, from my perspective, whether it's a remediation issue, an enforcement issue, it's clearly a clarity issue, because the message has not been received by the firms, or for that matter, potentially by our inspection staff. But they are finding problems in this area which go beyond a simple enforcement. So I think it is incumbent upon us to consider the approaches that you've outlined. I think there may be a consensus, although I may be overreaching, that there ought to be a general approach as opposed to a specific detailed approach. But then I think we may have a responsibility to get back to Steve the issue that you raised, so that you know exactly, you know, in more detail, with certain parameters, what we're finding. But as I say, I think this is an extremely important initiative because of the sheer volume of inspection reports that mention this issue, and it's mentioned year after year after year without successful remediation. So there is a gap in terms of what we're finding and the lack of action. So I applaud your bringing this up today, and you know, look forward to our moving it.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Rafferty, did you have?
Yeah, I would like to say, first of all, I agree it's a very important topic that should be discussed and dealt with, but I still question whether it is a policy or rule issue or an execution issue. And I think there may be times when inspection, if you are truly going out to do inspections and people are saying, I didn't know this was my responsibility, you may well want to challenge the validity of that assertion, because I do find it very difficult, and just from my own experience in our firm and in peer reviews, to believe that in most cases engagement teams particularly don't know precisely what their responsibilities are, which makes me question whether it's an execution versus a clarity issue. The other thing would be that if it is a clarity issue and it's that widespread, I agree, maybe rulemaking is the way to go. But in your document here that you wrote, you said it would facilitate the board's assessment through the inspection process of a firm's supervisory practices. It would seem to me that if you truly can't, in the inspection process, determine what those practices are, and the firm can't articulate that, then that would in fact be an inspection finding that would require remediation, and you could resolve a lot of these issues that way. But again, if it were truly widespread, then maybe rulemaking would be necessary.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Harris, did you have any other thoughts? No. Well, thank you very much for all of your thoughtful commentary. We'll take that under advisement, and also wanted to point out that if there's any additional thoughts that people around the table have or those listening to the webcast, the comment period is still open until November 3rd, and we encourage you to submit a comment letter because we really want to figure out what the best approach is and for the staff to analyze the comments we received today, the ones that will come in by November 3rd and present a balanced view to the board for their consideration. And now I'll turn it over to Marty for the next discussion topic.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Bella. And I echo Bella's thoughts. Thanks, everybody, for your thoughts on that subject. Well, we're coming down to our final subject of the day, and that is we proposed a new standard with respect to confirmations. The comment period on that is closed, and we've received many comments. And I've asked Dee Miranda-Gould to present a summary of the comments received, as we've been doing recently on other proposed standard-setting initiatives. So, Dee, you've got the final position.
Not working. Thanks, Marty. So as Marty said, we proposed a standard on confirmation, and the comment period ended September 13. And before I talk about some of the key themes in the comment letters that we received, just wanted to go through some of the key requirements, remind you of some of the key requirements that are in this proposed standard. So there's a lot of words on this slide, so it's a little hard to read, but we'll go through a little bit of the background on it. There is a requirement to confirm receivables. We broadened the terminology, so it includes receivables that arise from credit sales, loans, or other transactions. That terminology is found, actually, in FASB codification. It also includes a should confirm receivables. And that establishes a presumptively mandatory requirement to confirm receivables. And under the board's Rule 3101, the auditor must comply with requirements of this type unless the auditor demonstrates that alternative actions he or she followed in the circumstances were sufficient to achieve the objective of the standard. So thus, this includes, the proposed standard does not include a discussion of the exceptions to confirming receivables that were in the existing standard. The proposed standard also includes a requirement to confirm cash with financial institutions, and it includes a requirement to confirm other relationships with those financial institutions, including lines of credit, compensating balances, contingent liabilities, including guarantees, and the like. It includes a requirement to confirm significant risks or in response to significant risks, but it discusses the fact that confirmation might not be appropriate for all significant risks because its confirmation should be performed for those significant risks that relate to relevant assertions that can be adequately addressed by confirmation procedures. So the release is clear that we understand that not all significant risks will be able to be confirmed. The proposed standard includes requirements around maintaining control consistent with the existing requirement, but there are also some new requirements there. So, for example, it includes a requirement to perform procedures to determine the validity of addresses on confirmation requests. It also includes a requirement around management's requests not to confirm accounts and actions the auditor should consider to evaluate the implications of those requests. The proposed standard also includes a requirement for the auditor to evaluate the audit evidence. Now, that also was in the existing standard, but this proposed standard goes a little bit further in that it requires the auditor to perform alternative procedures for all non-responses. It includes requirements for the auditor to investigate each exception on a confirmation response, to assess the reliability of all confirmation responses, to evaluate the effect of disclaimers or restrictive language on the reliability of confirmation processes. We've heard the inclusion of disclaimers and restrictive language in confirmation responses has increased over time. We received 27 comments on the proposed standard, and the breakdown of the respondents is shown on this slide, so predominantly from accounting firms and association of accountants. And some of the key themes here, we generally received support for continuing to pursue a new standard to replace the existing standard. And primarily that support came from the fact that there have been advances in electronic communication that weren't dealt with under the existing standard. Some of the other things we heard from respondents are that we should consider modifying the standards to be more principles-based, risk-based, more consistent with the risk assessment standards. The board's encouraged to consider additional outreach to learn how the additional confirmation requirements will affect confirming parties. So the standard includes a number of requirements for auditors, but there is no ability to require confirming parties to actually respond to those confirmation requests. So we have been encouraged to consider outreach to understand that process to see if we can encourage better responses from confirming parties. A couple of other areas, we've received comments on the presumption to confirm receivables and the concern that we didn't include a statement about when exceptions are appropriate. And that's why I mentioned Rule 3101, because the should covers any possible exceptions. So there is no need to discuss exceptions in the standard. The other area was having the standard discuss any limitations on the use of internal audit or refer to the relevant auditing standard, AU Section 322. So there was some concern that we were planning to change practice and limit the use of internal audit. And other commenters mentioned that we should have more clear requirements, discussion of the intent related to internal audit and the standard. So I open it up if anybody has any thoughts or comments about the comment letters we received at this point.
Doug Anderson.
Okay, I'll jump in first this time, maybe in part because I was part of the group that drafted one of those comment letters. Two things I wanted to say. One was I think I expressed a year ago when SAG talked about this, so last year. I still believe this is a great example of a rule that's overly prescriptive in how it's structured. I think that, you know, the way paragraphs 8 and 9 are stated brings focus to two elements, receivables and cash. I love paragraphs 10 and 11 that talks about specific risks and talking about really focusing on the risk. And I know I have seen situations where receivable and cash are not the primary risk areas. And I think we fall into a trap with this. If we start off the discussion saying, think about receivables and cash, and, oh, by the way, if there's other good risks out there, address those too, puts it backwards. I think it should be stated, look at your risks and look at confirmations as a fabulous way to potentially get audit evidence. Base it on the risks of the situation, and two areas you want to give special consideration to are receivables and cash would be structured more appropriately around the risk of the environment. And then, of course, being an internal auditor or recently having been one, I'll just echo the comments you made at the end about the use of internal audit. I think, again, there, the way that the current wording is interpreted back in page 20 of the release, basically putting severe limitations around internal audit and how it can be used, again, may not be respective of the environment within a specific company. And I'd rather go back and just rely on 322. The way I'm worried if it's written now, and especially in the introduction to the standard, it's written now, it'll be interpreted to have a different approach than what we have in the standard right now in the use of internal audit.
Dee, I'd like to respond to Doug's point about, we had 2 points, one about being overly prescriptive and then internal audit, so I'll start with overly prescriptive. When we were developing the standard, I'm kind of thinking about Sam's comments about principles-based or rules-based, and the reality is it's a combination of both, and also Marty's comments yesterday about all our standards, as we're developing, consider the risk of fraud. This standard, certainly, as we were developing it, was for in considering the risk of fraud. Certainly, the requirement to confirm receivables to begin with came from a very significant fraud case, McKesson Robbins. And we even had discussion this morning about the concern about overstatement of revenue. So we had expanded the requirement there. Cash has also been an area where there's been alleged frauds regarding cash and even confirmation process. And even in the area of significant risks, our current standard today requires the auditor to at least, consider confirming things like significant or unusual complex terms, bill and hold arrangements, other things. Things that, in our view, would fall under the category of significant risk for which it would be appropriate to confirm. So confirmations, and oftentimes confirmations are used to get information, to identify frauds, whether maybe falsification of revenue. So for all those reasons, that was really driving our thinking about what to confirm. Plus, most of the firms today, if they don't explicitly require, they strongly encourage confirmation of cash. So that led to our thinking in developing the standard, and the procedures around it go to consider fraud risk factors, testing the validity of addresses. Say, are the auditors just not relying on what the company is giving them for where the companies are located? Because it could be one of their best friends, or making sure the auditor sends and receives. And then, so that was our perspective, and hopefully that helps as far as the standard and how we viewed it. The other thing on internal audit, what Doug is referring to in the release, we indicated that auditors could use internal auditors. However, in our view, and as we've indicated in the standard, when auditors send and receive confirmations, they shouldn't rely on the company or any other party. In our view, that included internal audit, because in our view, you're giving up control if I've given it to someone else. I've lost maintaining control over that process. Or even evaluating responses, we thought that was so important for the auditors. We did get comments saying, well, you should just go with 322 and allow that to continue. And be interested if you had any other thoughts on why internal auditors, why you think it's appropriate for them to send confirmations on behalf of the auditor, how the auditor would still maintain control in that process.
Yeah, just on those two thoughts. The first one, I'm not saying that confirmations receivable and cash are not good. Don't get me wrong. It comes into looking at this instead of relying on issues from a big issue from a couple of decades ago to drive how this standard is structured. I think the primary focus always needs to be on auditors need to focus on risk. And we need to have a singular focus on risk, and we need to look at confirmations, respond to that, and then see how to apply that thinking. This standard is structured today. Number one thought, beat up on receivables. Well, that may not be the number one thought. So it's not that I think confirmation receivables is wrong. I think it basically just sends the wrong message that maybe a not-so-smart auditor says, if I deal with receivables and I deal with cash, I must have the big things covered. Well, they may have missed the entire big risk areas of a company. So it's a question of emphasis and how it's structured and packaged is what I take issue with. I think it should be more focused on audit risk and designing confirmations for those high-risk areas, not necessarily presume that those will always be receivables and cash with zero balances, as the standard is basically implying now. And then back to the internal audit. I mean, I've seen a lot of different internal audit functions, and there are some great internal audit functions, and there are some really poor internal audit functions. And I think I'm pretty comfortable allowing the public accountant, the external auditor, assess and evaluate the strengths and the weakness of the internal audit functions, their objectivity, the way that they operate, as kind of guided by the current standard to decide how best to use internal audit in those circumstances. It may very well be a case that if confirmations are dealing with a medium or lower risk area, they still think it's an effective method. But in that risk profile, they're willing to take the situation that they think internal audit is objective, will do it objectively and do it professionally, and they go with that judgment. Right now, the way the standard and the release seems to be worded, you've said there will never be a situation where an internal audit could competently mail out some envelopes. And I'm not sure in every situation, every risk profile for every company with every internal auditor, that's the right answer. So I would leave it up more to the judgment of the auditor. That's just how I react to what I read.
Well, and that was in there. Internal audit is considered by auditors in two ways. One is internal audit can do their own work. They may go ahead and send their own confirmations and do tests, and auditors may consider that and reduce the nature, time, and extent of their procedures. So that part of it remains the same. The other thing is, they may decide to reduce the nature, time, and extent of their procedures, say, based on the work of internal audit, and use internal audit as part of their audit team. So it's counting as part of the auditor's own work, and that's kind of that's the part where we were placing, you know, it's so important, it's really your own work, and we think it's important enough that the auditors send and receive confirmations and evaluate those responses.
Well, Dee, I guess we've received the comment letters. We're in the process of analyzing them. Doug, thanks for your further comment today. I think to a large degree, your comment actually, I think, supports certainly one aspect that we added to the standard, which was for the auditor to confirm significant risks. And so you certainly, I think, supported the concept of a risk approach. And I think you're saying, think of our packaging. So I appreciate your comments, and I think as was said by Jennifer, we are mindful of investors' concerns about the risk of fraud, and it's forefront on the mind of investors, and as we're writing standards, whether they be the risk assessment standards that have been adopted or other standards we're proposing, the risk of fraud is high on our list as to the procedures that we require. Dee, thanks for your presentation of the comments. We'll take all the comments we receive in the letters, obviously, into account as we think about our next steps in this regard and make a proposal to the board. We've reached that part of the meeting where the good news is I typically give a very short wrap-up, and that's I get credit for that, as everybody has their planes to make, et cetera. I want to thank everybody for their participation in this meeting. It was very lively throughout, and everybody was very actively engaged. To a large degree, I also want to attribute that to the SAG members' input to us. I reach out to SAG members before these meetings, and many of you supported the concept of continuing the discussion around the FASB proposals, the change in the accounting framework, and the impact on the potential impact on auditing, which certainly engendered a lot of discussion at the last meeting and equally lively discussion at this meeting. And so the input I I get from all of you in putting the agenda together is very valuable, and I'll certainly continue to reach out before SAG meetings to do that. I certainly can't and don't want to summarize a day and a half's worth of discussions, and since we don't ask for consensuses and vote, it's hard to do anyway. But we did hear a number of, I think, important things that I take away. On Dan talked yesterday morning about the legislation that we're asking for to fix the fact that our enforcement actions are currently private, and I certainly think there was a lot of support for that proposal, and I think everybody felt that was extremely important. The other matter that Dan talked about on uninspected firms, a number of people addressed that at the meeting and otherwise talked to me even later on about things that we could do regarding a greater disclosure of that issue, whether it be through audit reports or whatever it might be, is a really important issue. So we've taken that away. With respect to the standard setting agenda that I spent some time on yesterday morning, I think I got a response that it was a robust yet appropriate agenda. But some items came up from others, such as SAS 70 for us to think about. The subject of transparency reporting came up as part of that. And while I mentioned independence was not on the agenda, some said we're glad to know that it's on our radar, even though it's not on the agenda yet, because maybe it should be. On the quality control standards, I think it was a very good discussion, and I think we got a lot of support for the fact that we need to put a concept release out or a document out of some type, as everybody feels the importance of quality controls to good audits and good audit practice. So we got a lot of good input yesterday afternoon on thoughts about quality control from tone on the top, culture on downwards, and that was very valuable input to us. And again, I just want to repeat one more time the conversation today on auditability issues raised by the changes in the framework. It was a very helpful dialogue, and it reinforces the need on the part of my office to continue to talk to the FASB about developments and the SEC developments in this area as we consider auditing standards in this environment. I have no further comments to make other than to say thank you and meeting adjourned, unless, Dan, you have any comments you'd like to make.
No, I'll just join you in thanking everyone for their participation and look forward to seeing you at the next meeting.
Good. Thank you very much.